Okay. Let's get started. It's Friday, March 9th. This is the Senate Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division. And the first bill that the committee has before it this morning is Senate File 1029, Senator Saxhog. Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today I'm presenting Senate File 1029. I do have an author's amendment that I'd like to move. I think you have in front of you. It's the A1.
Member, the A1 amendment has been distributed. Senator Saxhog moves the adoption of the A1 amendment. This is the first committee. It's been two, so it's an author's amendment. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries and the amendment's adopted. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill will appropriate $350,000 a year in the next biennium to Let's Go Fishing. This program helps seniors enjoy our lakes and gives them an opportunity to drop a line in the water and have a little fun. And on a more serious note, I think that we've heard in testimony all of this year that we're continuing to see a shrinkage in the number of fishing licenses sold, and I think this is a real opportunity for us to work on increasing the amount of participation in a great sport. So with me today is Joe Holm, Executive Director of Let's Go Fishing, and Dave Larson, the Operations Finance Officer, and they're going to show a short video and then give some short testimony.
Mr. Holm and Mr. Larson, welcome to the committee. And before you start, why don't you just identify yourself on the tape so that we know who you are and can identify the voices.
I'm Joe Holm, Director of Let's Go Fishing.
And I'm David Larson, Financial and Operations Officer at Let's Go Fishing.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Enjoy fishing? Well, we never grow old. Well, to prove that, we recently joined a bunch of senior citizens who fish like kids. Some loves last a lifetime. One of them is fishing.
I had a nibble.
A nibble means a lot when you can't fish the way you...
It's technology, Mr. Chair.
It's not under normal.
Right, we'll do it at the end. We'll let it warm up.
For having us, we were hoping to show a short video. It was on Minnesota Bound, and about a program that's been very, very important to literally thousands of seniors around Minnesota. Last time we were here, it started from an idea. There was three chapters around the state at that point. With your help, we've expanded that to where we're presently at 15. I just want to thank you for that simply because we've taken out several thousand people. In 2007, we'll have approximately 7,500 people that we've had out. While this is getting warmed up, or are we there? All of you were handed have got a packet, and on this packet is what we're going to go through just on the left side. So on the left side where it says Communities Serving Seniors, talks about Let's Go Fishing, the free fishing and boating excursions for seniors with the theme of giving back to those who've given so much to us. Are we there? Okay. If you turn to the first page, the mission of Let's Go Fishing is dedicated to enriching the lives of individuals age 55 years and greater through fishing and boating excursions that strengthen communities, build relationships, and create memories. The key, I think, on this page is you can see the past 5 years, it's gone from an idea to something small to something that's built to a very significant program. The senior guests that we've impacted has been over 9,000 just this last 5 years. We're going on our sixth year. We ended up with a little over 725 volunteers. We expect that to be over 1,000 this year. We have found that it's giving people back something that Minnesota is all about for years, and that is about the lakes. It's about fishing. It's about getting out there and putting a smile on their face. Many of them, because of health reasons, just cannot load and unload a boat like they used to. Maybe a loss of spouse, maybe no one to go with, maybe not the equipment. And we have found that the list goes on, and even that of a financial reason. Many of them don't have the finances. Going on to the second page, who's benefited? These are all the people who have benefited from the program, both as different groups that have benefited from the program, and then also individuals that have benefited from the program. So people of all walks of life have really impacted from this program. Going on to the next page, you'll see that in regards to how has it benefited the seniors on the left, and on the right, how has it benefited the communities. Very, very strong points, and it really has brought people together. It's brought communities together. On the bottom of that page, you'll see a breakdown of what has taken place in terms of numbers. Seniors that we've reached, volunteers, volunteer hours. I think what's very significant is what's highlighted in gold on the right, and that is statistics with the state fundings when we were here last time and how it made a huge, huge difference. So on behalf of the seniors, I want to thank you for that. Going on to the next page where we're talking about the program growth. Are we here? Okay.
Say those of us who enjoy fishing, well, we never grow old. Well, to prove that, we recently joined a bunch of senior citizens who fish like kids. Some loves last a lifetime. One of them is fishing.
I had a nibble.
A nibble means a lot when you can't fish the way you once could. But at any age, there's hope.
Nice one. Smallmouth.
Harold Vandevand is fishing today because a Wilmer, Minnesota fellow named Joe Holm cared enough to take him and a boatload of other senior anglers.
Sometimes you just have to step out in faith and follow through with some of the things you got a deep conviction about.
Oh, goody.
Convinced senior citizens would love to go fishing if given the chance, Joe founded a volunteer organization called Let's Go Fishing.
I tell my wife that I got two full-time jobs, but this is the one that pays the long-term dividends. There is so much gratification that comes from helping people, and to see that smile on their face, and to know that you made a difference.
Using volunteers as fishing guides, a fishing trip for seniors doesn't cost a dime.
You know, I think that a lot of times those seniors think they're forgotten, and we don't want them to think that way. We invite them out, and it's just like they're at a party here.
It's just really awesome getting the seniors out on the water. My mom and dad passed away about 2 years ago. They were 93 and 92. And then when Joel introduced this concept, I thought it was the greatest thing I could think of because my mom and dad were unable to get on the water at a certain point in their lives.
It's wonderful. That's something money can't buy. Friendship. I tell you, we're in the sunset of our lives, and it starts to cloud over a little bit, and there's nothing more interesting than to get out with friends, knowing you've got friends. These have been a wonderful bunch of guys.
This is a priceless idea that they had of giving seniors a chance to go out and enjoy themselves. Just, I can't say enough about it. I really like it. You know, I'm a retired teacher, and some of these volunteers I had in school. So it's kind of nice to have them helping me. But one time I helped them. So that's just payback.
A payback, perhaps, Founder Joe Holm is hoping the idea spreads from Minnesota's Green Lake to fishing waters across America.
I think the older all of us get, the more sensitive we really become that life is fragile. And you don't know when your time's up. And that friendship, somebody just come out, put your arm around them, and just treat them like a fishing buddy.
Well, it was a blast.
Yeah, yes, it was.
That was really...
Let's go fishing. Not a bad idea at any age.
The program is reaching people. It's reaching thousands of people through thousands of volunteers, and it's just been unbelievable about the individuals that have earned their stripes through the course of the year. And the older we get, the less number of activities there is for all of us, especially when you get to the seniors. Last year when we were invited to the governor's opener, Governor Plenty came up, and as we shook hands, he says, "I just want you to know all the good I've heard around the state about Let's Go Fishing. Keep up the good work." We are very encouraged by that, and we are hearing those type of reports really on a weekly basis. We're getting letters from family of really what it's meaning to people. We thought in the front end it would put a few smiles on people's faces, but it's done way more than that. It's given them back something that they've enjoyed for years, and that all of us, maybe I'm talking just about myself now, it's easy to take for granted the lakes and being able to go out and enjoy those lakes. Getting back to our chart of the state of Minnesota, highlighted in black, last time we were here with pre-state funds, there was three organizations around the state. And then we received the state funds, and that's where you can see all the yellow highlighted areas where it went up to 13. So far for the year, there's three additional, and those are highlighted in green. The following page is a strategic development plan that Let's Go Fishing has put in place, which it's dependent upon the fundings that's received. What's in presently in the circles are different nest eggs that we are really hoping to penetrate those areas. Quite honestly, we're getting calls from not only communities all over the state, but communities in other states as well. Our hope and goal is that we can use Minnesota can model the way for other states. The metro area is a huge area that we did not want to pursue unless we knew we had adequate funding to do a good job to serve the people in this area. Presently, we have numbers of people traveling from the metro west, believe it or not, 2 hours one way just to do this. Flipping it over, you'll see where the need is and where the request is. We're requesting $350,000 for the next 2 years. Again, you'll see what it would accomplish using the past as a template. This is no longer an idea. It's an idea. It's an idea that has worked to a full-fledged program to where by the end of 2009, which would be the funding, we would literally have over 22,000 people out in the water, which is just incredible. And as far as the numbers of seniors that we would reach through the numbers of promotional activities that we have, it would be approximately 150,000. So you can see where those numbers and how that's growing. We truly feel it's a unique program with an unlimited amount of potential. It's stated that in the next 20 years, one in four of us will be seniors. We know for a fact that it's getting more and more seniors. Up in Bemidji, they had a meeting, the city did, as far as what are we going to do with the high numbers of seniors that are coming up? What are we going to be doing for them? The Let's Go Fishing program, they implemented it, and it's been wonderful. And we've been seeing great reports like that throughout the whole state. I wanted to keep it brief and allow for some questions at this point.
All right. Thank you very much, and thanks for that great video. That was terrific. Just makes us... Can't wait for spring, huh? You mentioned the metro area and all the plans for growth that you have. What you think that with this appropriation that you're requesting in this bill that you'd be able to expand to all these areas? How many chapters?
Actually, ma'am, the way it works is that we've identified four target areas throughout the state of Minnesota, depending on funding. On your map in the packet on page 6, the blue circles identify specific funding that we've identified for 07 and going forward to support chapter development and sustainment. The red, the green, and the brown all represent additional funding, additional opportunities to start chapters. Each area, we've identified different funding opportunities to help start the program. If we had additional funds, we would be able to develop those areas further and add additional areas throughout the state. So what we're trying to do is go to where the funding is currently for 07 and expand in those areas. If additional funds come available, we do have plans to expand to those areas.
Okay. And then the funding would be enough to sustain those chapters once they're started, or do they become self-sustaining?
The chapters really become self-sustaining after about the second season, ma'am. Based on what we're seeing, the chapters are able to raise their annual operating budget very easily internally throughout their communities.
Oh, that's good. Okay, and then I just have a question. What do you mean by promotional attendees?
Yes, ma'am. Our promotional events, our chapters participate in activities throughout the year. Those can be parades, festivals, fish fries, different community events that we help sponsor or are a part of, county fairs, where our volunteers are there talking about the program, giving promotion about the program, about Let's Go Fishing, looking for additional volunteers, obviously talking to potential sponsors and donors to the program. So each chapter really takes the opportunity throughout the year to participate in a lot of community activities to get the word out about the program. I'll give you an example. We had a gal from St. Peter contact our state office after she had attended a parade. Actually, it was in Wilmer with her daughter. She saw the float go through the parade. She wrote down the phone number, and she called us about starting a program in her community. So those kind of opportunities we always try to capitalize on.
And some of the seniors that you serve, that you take fishing, they ride on the parade floats and participate in these events?
Yes, ma'am. Absolutely.
Okay, great. I bet they enjoy it. So, okay, good. Any other questions from committee members?
Madam Chair, I just have a comment. There's a program in Sleepy Eye in my district, and I drive by Sleepy Eye Lake fairly often, and I often see the Let's Go Fishing float out there with a pontoon full of seniors fishing.
Yes.
Looks like fun.
Sleepy Eye program is extremely successful.
Yeah. Madam Chair, and as you probably know, there are two nursing homes. Sleepy Eye is a community of about 3,500 people, and there's two nursing homes and some assisted living facilities there. So there's a good senior population that would take advantage of it.
We are getting calls, if I might add, we're getting calls from communities all over the state, and we just don't have the manpower. You're basically looking at it right up here right now. We just don't have, we're overwhelmed, and we like to keep our wife happy and a little bit more with the time has just been incredible. But the reward for what it's doing for the communities is just been really great. We're up as far north right now as Bemidji and west as far as Ortonville. We're up in North Branch, south of Sleepy Eye, St. James. Fairmont is starting now and everywhere in between. So we've got a strategic plan put together. We feel that we've been very diligent and used the past monies very wisely, and in going forward where we can maximize getting as many people out as possible.
Madam Chair?
It's Senator Saxog.
Madam Chair, I'd move that we lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus.
Okay, great. Thank you. Senator
Environment Finance
Bill. Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, Senator Saxog. Do we know, has there been any effort with the Lake Vermilion Sportsmen's Club to expand this to Vermilion?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, I'm going to defer to Mr. Holmes on this. It's moving that way, but as you say, Mr. Holmes, there's right now you haven't gotten that far north. Is that correct?
We have not talk to them as of this point. We have not been contacted by them. Our plan is to have an individual that would literally take care of that whole area in helping set up and help sustain, which is the two areas where we need the manpower to go.
I was just curious, Madam Chair, because I sent some brochures of the program to them. And I talked to some of the members, and they seemed very interested in it.
Yeah, we're finding that throughout the whole state. There's a tremendous interest. The communities, we're getting more and more elder, and that's a fact of life. And we've got the lakes, we've got the fishing that they've enjoyed. And I'd like to add, it's adding a tremendous amount of fishing licenses every year.
I bet. And, you know, it occurs to me that, you know, they age 55, most of the people in the video, I think probably most of the people you're serving are in their upper senior years. We age, a lot of folks who are over 55 don't think of themselves as seniors. Senator Saxhog, my husband, would agree with you there. He's not a senior, no. So I think, you know, that's the new middle age, right? So for quite a while. So do you have any problem with, you know, folks who are, you know, 57 who want to come and do this, who maybe don't really need the help? I would think this is really more targeted at some of the older seniors who don't have a lot of opportunities to get out and do things.
Senator Anderson, that's partially correct, but we open up the doors for all age brackets, all walks of life, and we're getting just that. It's not just one end or the other. It's a good cross section. So,
Madam Chair,
Senator Kubley.
Well, those of us on this side of the table would like to ask you to be a little more cautious in referring to your spouse as an older person. Most of us are older.
Just so I don't get in trouble at home, I
then
think
we might
I was
have to
clarifying
ask exactly what age that is.
That he's not a senior citizen.
And, tell me.
And so let's just, for the record, none of us are, okay? Yeah. All right, on Senator Saxhog's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no, motion prevails. Thank you very much. Senator Pariseau?
Thank you, ma'am.
All right, big trouble.
Madam Chair and members, this is a very short bill, as you can tell by looking at it, one whole paragraph. It does ask for an appropriation of $200,000 from the general fund to the DNR for master planning on the land purchase that was before. I mentioned there was another bill with money in it, and the first one didn't have money, and so Senate File 711 was the university property purchased by DNR. At any rate, this is intended for them to, because the cooperation is going on between all the entities right now, and that would be the university, the county, and DNR are working very well together. But this is in order to inventory some of the land and establish what would be appropriate for prairie and wetland restorations. So $200,000 appropriation. And I have Mr. Meyer from DNR, and we're trying to find Barry Tilley, who's outside, I believe, for the county's behalf.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. The bill before you today actually originated in the House with Representative McNamara, who was very instrumental in this whole procedure of allowing the university and the department to work on the UMOR, actually, which will be called the Vermilion Highlands Wildlife Resource and Recreation Area here after we pass some legislation in the Game of Fish Bill. This bill, Representative McNamara and Senator Pariseau would like to see happen, would appropriate $200,000 to the DNR to accelerate our master planning process and resource inventory. It would allow us to get the plans up to speed a lot faster than what we have currently in the budget, and also to give us the direction that we need to go in order to provide the prairie and wetland restoration activities. This is not in the governor's budget, however, but it would allow us to do the work that we're anticipating on doing over the next 10 to 15 years in a much faster and expeditious manner.
Madam Chair and members, I would draw your attention, if you still have it in your packet, the packet that had this colorful map on the front, and page 18 is the diagrammed map about the property that we're talking about. So anybody needs to look at that and refresh their memory, they'd know it.
We had that in Senator Chaudhry's committee.
Right, right.
Yes.
Madam Chair, Barry Tilley from Dakota County.
Mr. Tilley.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barry Tilley, and I'm here representing the Dakota County Board of Commissioners. And I just wanted to voice support for this bill. This asset coming into the public domain for public usage is just such an incredible opportunity. We are so pleased in Dakota County to be treated as a full partner, though we're not a voting partner. We feel like one because of the incredible working relationship we have with the Department of Natural Resources and the University of Minnesota. We would like to voice support for this bill Senator Paraso is bringing forward to help pay some of the costs. This is a state asset, not just a local Dakota County asset, and we didn't feel it was right for the entire state of Minnesota to benefit from the work of just one county. We're more than happy. We're going to put in more than our share of the costs of this, but if you could take this small step to help defray some of the hard costs, we would greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Tilley. Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Myers, am I correct that because of the recent acquisition of this property, that there's basically been no master planning done to this point?
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, you are correct. The activities to date have focused on a large planning process, just dealing with the uses of the lands themselves and trying to figure out what may be allowed, how to deal with moving forward. You know, this is going to, the DNR does not take actual possession of the land for 25 years, but the report that we discussed in the policy committee outlines the process that was established and where we're moving forward on dealing with the lands. There's a substantial amount of planning and development, natural resource conservation development that needs to take place, dealing with the munitions activities that occurred on the land, dealing with some of the buildings that need to take place, the transition of ag lands into prairie and wetlands, the roads, the uses that are out there, the existing gun club. So this bill would allow us to develop a complete master plan to follow and to lead us down that road of complete restoration.
Madam Chair, members, I believe it's complicated a little bit more the fact that this isn't going to all be the same use on the entire property eventually. There are several kinds of uses, and so that's a complicating factor.
Madam Chair, Mr. Myers, do you need the $200,000 up front in one appropriation, or is this a stage planning process where you could start with a smaller amount and require and have additional monies appropriated later? What is the timeline for doing this work, and what is the dollars associated with that timeline?
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, the upfront appropriation would accelerate the master planning process. As envisioned right now, the department would work with the stakeholders, picking up pieces of that master planning process within our existing budgets. Over the next 10, 15 years. What this bill would allow for would provide a complete master planning process to be done within the next probably biennium, and we would accomplish that, and then we wouldn't have to kind of piecemeal it together as what we're planning right now.
Madam Chair, Ms. DeMyers, will the Department of Natural Resources be doing all of this work, or will the University of Minnesota be participating in it also?
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, I would anticipate the planning process or the master planning process would involve all of the partners from the work group that was previously established, University of Minnesota, Dakota County. You'll see there's a resolution and agreement that we entered into with the University, DNR, Dakota County, and other stakeholders dealing with the management of those lands. So it wouldn't be a planning process that the DNR would invoke on by ourselves. There's a lot of people involved in the use and planning of those lands.
Madam Chair, one last question. Is the University of Minnesota going to bring some of their resources into this planning also, or if they aren't, would they could?
Well, and I was going to ask if there's any local match as well, so we'll start with the university. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senator Fredrickson, for the record, my name is Todd Iverson. I represent the University of Minnesota. I know that we've had this honestly has been one of the really good working relationships that the university has entered into in the last several years, and I know that the university is committed to making this a smooth transition and that we would participate fully in the planning process. We've spent several hours and several dollars in the planning process so far and have been very satisfied with that outcome, and we plan to continue that effort.
There's a statutory provision passed last year, it looks like, that said that the DNR, in cooperation with the university, shall submit to the governor and the legislature by January 15, 2007, an assessment of the plans for development of this land. Is that okay? Is that what we had? I don't think we have that here today, but is that what we had in Senator Chaudhry's committee?
Madam Chair, members, yes, that is what we presented and we worked through our presentation off of. If anybody needs additional copies, I can get additional copies for the committee.
But how does this go beyond that plan or that assessment?
Madam Chair, members, the master planning process would actually drill down several layers deeper than what that overall assessment was. The assessment that was presented to the legislature was kind of a 10,000-foot level approach as to get an agreement between all the stakeholders on what actually may be done with the lands. The master plan process would put pen to paper and outline where some of those trails should be, where should the prairie restorations take place, and what priority, what wetlands should be preserved or restored, in what timeline and fashion. It would basically pull together. It's the next steps involved with the planning process that we invoked on last session.
And do you anticipate any, it says in here, remediating pollution from older activities. Are there problems in that area?
Madam Chair, we are working with Representative Klein diligently on having the Corps of Engineers come out and do testing, and they have agreed to do an assessment. And we are working forward with that through the PCA. The PCA is the state agency that's directing that, and I'm sure they would be happy to come in and give you a full report if you want it. I don't have all the details with me, but I know that we continue to work on a federal level to ensure that the cleanup that is necessary will occur, and we do have a commitment from the federal government now to do that assessment.
And this, Senator Pariseau, will you be coming in with a bonding request? I mean, the next actually implementing all these ideas is going to cost a lot of money, I assume.
Well, Madam Chair, I have to just people who don't live down there don't know how many decades the university has owned this property and how many proposals they had through the years of what they were going to do with it. We're just wide community involvement in it, and none of them ever took place except that the research on there will continue to happen. And the contaminated sites is not, I mean, it's over 7,000 acres, but there's no way that all that acreage is contaminated. And identifying the exact sites is going to be probably exactly what will happen with what the university plans to pull from the federal government. And that is their responsibility, the federal government as well. So.
But the purpose of this plan is, I assume, to take it, it's a create a plan, and then you will try to implement the plan. So I assume there will be more costs.
Well, there will be ongoing costs, Madam Chair, I'm sure. But at this time, this is what we would need for the next step of the planning, because the task force has been brought together, or the council. I'm not sure what they're called. We have too many terms around here that mean the same thing. At any rate, that group will continue to operate.
Okay. Any other questions?
And there are so many different kinds of uses that we won't have to test every acre of ground.
And this, and sorry, I'm just trying to okay, that's all. I don't have any other questions. Senator Pariseau, do you want to make a motion?
I would move that Senate File 742 be, what is the appropriate?
Laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you. That's the motion, Madam Chair.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. All right, Senator Chaudhry.
Nope. Might be buried.
Let's go fishing if he's such a big supporter of that. The photo op. Do you want us to taste your face?
Someone to pass these out.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm starting to believe less and less in coincidence. This is the weekend of the Minnesota Deer Classic. It's an expo on deer hunting. They have at the State Fair in your district. 5 years ago today, I was at the Minnesota Deer Classic, and I walked by an exhibit. Actually, it was just a folding table, and there were some badly copied information sheets on the table about wildlife on our roadsides. And I picked it up. It happened to catch my eye, and I picked it up and started reading it and said, hmm. And started thinking more and more about how much impact our roadsides have on our wildlife. In fact, up to almost half, in a lot of areas in our state, half of all pheasant hatchings occur on the sides of our roads. Half. And as a sportsman, it occurred to me, if we could preserve our roadsides better, manage our mowing policies better on the roadsides, manage our noxious weed spraying better, manage the haying practices better, and our different types of prairie plantings when we build our roads or refurbish our roads, we could really do a lot for wildlife, not only as a pheasant hunter, but for bird watching, for other small animals, and even duck hunting. So I embarked on this kind of study on how we can go about improving this program that languished on the vine. We used to have one. We didn't anymore. How can we improve our mowing laws and all that? And so I worked with Senator Sams in creating a task force on studying roadside issues, on how we could revive the program, what policies we can look at, what types of funding we would need, what we could do with that funding. We came back with a recommendation 2 years ago that we could do a fair amount with what's our budget?
$200,000
for biennium. With $100,000 a year. And so we worked on it, and I worked with Senator Sams and Senator Bach when he was carrying that bill, and in fact it was Senator Fredrickson's motion in this committee that put that $200,000 of general fund money into this program one time. And since then we have I was then appointed to the advisory council, and the DNR hired a director, and since then the issue of roadsides for wildlife has really snowballed. And we're going to learn a little bit more about the issue from DNR. But it's really been incredible what that little amount of money has done in just 2 years in promoting this issue, promoting our wildlife practices. Hundreds of thousands of acres of native grasses, of non-native grasses, are all that acreage that we somehow forget about because we focus on wildlife management areas, state forests, all of these things, but we don't see the tend to focus on the ultimate habitat corridor, and that's our roadsides. So we'll talk a little bit more about it. Carmelita Nelson is the director. She's not a full-time director of the program, but there's a lot of coordinating that has gone on between DNR and Department of Transportation. Frank Pafko, the director of Environmental Services, is a has been a strong supporter of this program, and there's just been a lot of synergy going on with this program in just 2 years. So I'll turn it over to Carmelina Nelson.
Thank you, Senator Chaudhry. I had a beautiful PowerPoint all ready for you guys, but technology gets in the way again. So I do have it as a handout. You can kind of follow through. Basically,
can
I'd like to highlight.
Self, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Carmelita Nelson, DNR Roadsides for Wildlife Coordinator. The handout goes down the page in case you're trying to follow it. But basically, I'd like to thank you for letting us come here. We all drive the roadsides. We all travel the roadsides every day. But we maybe don't take time to look at the roadsides. We have over 500,000 acres of land on our little ribbons of highways along the sides. And this 500,000 acres of land is permanent grassland. It will not be forested because we have to have it for safety as grassland. So this provides very much benefits of habitat. Now, I haven't even told this to Senator Chaudhry, but I've been doing some research. In addition to habitat for 40 nesting species, there's over 100 species of birds that use the roadsides, 20 species of mammals, including little things like bats and moles and shrews, and then there's also 20 species of reptiles and amphibians. So it really is an important habitat, even though we don't really notice it unless you happen to break down and have to walk along the roadside. And in 2005, the legislature did approve to do some habitat improvement for the roadsides, and they made three major changes. One was that road authorities could not mow until August 1st, and that is very key for the wildlife because most wildlife is nesting in June and July. By the end of July, most wildlife is done nesting. So by August 1st, it's okay to mow. You won't be hurting the wildlife as much. The other thing was to try to promote using native vegetation in our roadsides, and that has been a very key thing as well. And the other thing was to encourage professional cooperation between DNR and DOT, which we have done, but we've done even more in this case. So the basic program has followed those three key components. The other piece that we have added is to preserve the native prairie that is along our roadsides. There's not very much left, but it's very important as a seed source. Some of the accomplishments that we have done is to develop best management practices with the DOT, and we have a whole set of those. I won't go all through those, but those have been very good, and they've been getting put into their maintenance manuals as well. They actually never had a chapter on wildlife in their maintenance manual, so this is one big thing that we've added. The other key thing that we've been working with the DOT is their Living Snow Fence program. This is basically, and it's been incredible this last couple of snowstorms we've had, to go out and photograph these living snow fences because you can really see where they do make a huge difference in roadside safety, but they're also wonderful habitat for wildlife. The native vegetation program has been really tying along with the whole cellulosic fuel industry. We see that potentially in the future, roadsides can provide 500,000 acres of prairie that could be harvested as a cellulosic fuel. This is long-term thinking. We're talking 15, 20 years before this could actually occur, but it is a possibility. And the very best thing about using native vegetation on roadsides is that it prevents erosion and it improves water quality because the biomass of prairie is mostly under the ground. You'll be hearing more about forestry where most of the biomass is above ground. Prairie, it's underground. So it is incredible for soil erosion and also for water quality. The other thing is we provided a great deal of training to DOT. We've trained over 400 DOT staff, and we've also gone to the townships and the counties as well to do some training. The other key piece about doing prairie is that one-third of the state used to be covered with prairie, and now we're down to less than 1%. But I think it is really important for our children to go and see prairies. I was at my son's kindergarten talking about natural resources, and one of the little girls raised her hand and says, "What's a prairie?" And I thought, this is terrible because, I mean, children are growing up not even knowing what a prairie is. They know what a forest is, but they don't know what prairies are. So I think it's very important that we have our children and our future generations know what is prairie. And no matter if they never get out of their car, if they have it along the roadsides, they could still see what a prairie is. And if you may think, well, that's kind of impossible to redo all this, if you go down to Iowa, you can see what they have done. And it really, you can see prairie on the roadsides of Iowa. So it can be done. Some of our other things that we've done is a lot of promotional activities and things like that. We're going to be doing a lot more this coming summer. Other opportunities is to include working with more partners, working with the railroads. We haven't really started making that connection, working with connecting other wildlife areas and federal lands as well so that we can have corridors with prairie connecting different other prairie sites. The other one I mentioned is the whole cellulosic fuel, that it is a potential source. But the biggest thing I see as a benefit of this roadsides program, if you turn to your third page, it shows a picture of a meadowlark. And it shows the meadowlark graph. In the 1960s, you could see, I'm not going to be able to read this. I think it's about 25 species of meadowlarks. Every time you stopped your car, you could see 25 birds. Now you get out, and you're lucky to see one or two. Meadowlarks have become very rare, and that is because they are a ground-nesting bird that gets mowed over every year in June and July. So just improving the habitat is a really great thing. We have a lot of different future programs that we have planned if this program gets funded, which we hope it does. Not only has this $200,000 done a lot within the DNR, but the DOT, we are very thankful, has worked with the Federal Highway Transportation to double that amount. $400,000 have been leveraged through this program to get additional funding to work on the Prairie Passage route from Iowa border up to I-95, or I-35 going to I-90. And they're just kind of picking away, trying to restore some of the prairie. So we've been getting quite a lot of federal dollars as a result of this small $200,000 program. So that's a very brief summary, and I think I'll wrap up.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. Senator Shadway, we have two other people listed. Did they want to testify, too? Wayne Edgerton and Dan Gullickson. Welcome to the committee.
Tell them I'm on. Okay, you don't have to. It's fine over there for you. Okay,
thank you. Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Wayne Edgerton. I'm Ag Policy Coordinator with the Minnesota DNR. Appreciate the opportunity to come before you this morning and do the brief presentation that Current Leader Nelson just provided for you as an update. We basically are here as to provide that for you and to answer any questions that you have. This is a program that, as Senator Chaudhry mentioned earlier, has been around for quite a few years, was lacking in funding until relatively recently, and the funding that we provide that was provided to the program a few years ago has helped greatly. The partnership was mentioned. We have Dan Gullickson here as well from MnDOT, and that partnership also includes other local units of government, such as Association of Minnesota Counties, Pheasants Forever, and some other local folks. So with that, I guess I'll turn it over to Dan, unless you have any questions for me.
Great. Thank you very much. Mr. Gullickson.
Madam Chair, my name is Dan Gullickson. I'm the Living Snow Fence Program Coordinator for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. I work with Frank Pafko, who's the director of our office. He could not be here today because of a death in his family. But I can testify that the Roadsides for Wildlife program through the DNR has been a huge blessing for DOT. We've been able to do more with our Living Snow Fence program as a result of the heightened awareness with sportsmen's groups through this program. And as Senator Chaudhry mentioned, this thing is kind of snowballing in terms of the opportunity to piggyback with additional money that DOT has put forth towards the program. For example, Carmelita talked about the planting of restoration of native prairie on the I-90 corridor. Some of the other things that we've put money into in partnership with the DNR is to look at how we manage our roadsides to improve safety in terms of saving money, in terms of how we manage our roadsides and getting these into our maintenance manual. So that's been a very good thing. And so I strongly encourage you to continue to support the program because it is making a difference on the land, and it is going to be a huge savings in the long run.
All right. Thank you. Senator Frederickson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Gullickson, I just wanted to verify a couple of statistics that were on a information distributed to us from the Department of Natural Resources, and really doesn't have much to do with the roadside for wildlife habitat, but I'm just surprised at a couple of statistics here. One of them is on this sheet is that 40% of state highways are owned in fee title and 60% in easement. I was under the assumption that virtually all, if not all, state highways are owned fee title. And the next surprising statement to me, at least, is most county roadsides are controlled by easements. I was under the impression that all county state aid highways were owned fee title, and probably most of the county roads were. Could you verify if these are accurate? Or?
Madam Chair, Senator Frederickson, this is something that we've been looking at, and these are actually quite accurate. Our state highway system, majority of it is we don't have complete control of the right-of-way in terms of the haying and that type of thing that occurs there. So it's basically the easements that we have, an easement to have the highway there, but the underlying fee owners who we bought that from, they still have control over that. So in terms of the numbers there, those are pretty correct. We are looking at, hopefully in the future, trying to do more work with GIS to help us look at corridors where we can help connect habitat wildlife areas with one another. But those numbers are pretty correct there.
Madam Chair, Senator Mr. Gullickson, doesn't the federal government require that we own the highway's fee title before we can spend federal money on them? Maybe this isn't your field of expertise, I realize that, but I'm just surprised at the statistics here.
Madam Chair, Senator Frederickson, one of the things, like with our interstate highway system, a lot of that land we own in fee. And so that is indeed the case with our interstate systems. But we have 12,000 miles of roadway, and you know, much of that we don't have 100% control over the right-of-way in regards to whether it be easement or fee title.
Thank you for the information.
Madam Chair, Senator Frederickson, that's one of the things I was going to build upon. What we've discovered in this whole process is how complex the ownership issue is in terms of actually doing things on the ground. The whole issue of ground disturbance before or after August 1st is critical to road the wildlife. And we can do things as where we own the fee title, and have a lot more control over that to make sure that we don't have a lot of roadside disturbance before August 1st, when the next nesting occurs. But when we have such a checkerboard ownership system along the roads, as is explained here, it's hard to get others to buy into that, particularly with regards to the haying issue. And even when we do have rules about and explicit agreements that someone will be haying, for example, after August 1st, they have a contract to hay a certain roadside, someone will come in on their own over the weekend and just hay it in violation of someone else's ownership rights to hay that area. So we've encountered a number of complexities with that. The other thing we've discovered is that the real key players in this issue is really not the state or federal county officials, but it's those county engineers that are there kind of day-to-day with the mowing and the plowing. And those are the people that are really are on the ground and see what's happening, and they've been involved with our task force as well, and they're a critical stakeholder in all of this. We spent a lot of time at their conventions and their conferences, surveying, discussing, listening on this issue. So that's one thing we've learned, that it's those county engineers are a critical player to all of this.
Okay. Senator Chaudhry, you're asking for $150,000 a year. Is that in addition to the governor's recommendation, or a supplement to what's your proposal here?
The governor's recommendation, and that's what these guys support, is $100,000 a year to continuing on from what we've done, and having that as part of the Game and Fish Fund, coming out of the Game and Fish Fund. My bill proposes an additional $50,000 a year, which they are not authorized to support, but I am encouraging the committee to support, because this program has done so well, and with so little money, they've done so much, and they can do so much more with an additional $50,000 a year. If it came out of the general fund, if it came out of the Game and Fish Fund, I'd be fine either way. I'd be certainly happy with $150,000 a year out of the Game and Fish Fund.
Thank you.
As well.
I think I just have to point out that the first two bills that we had are not in the governor's budget at all. But we did hear about support from the governor for Let's Go Fishing. We heard about the DNR seemed to support Senator Parisot's bill, but I know there's no money there in the budget for them, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Well, our task force, when we had our report presented 2 years ago, had a list of things that we could do with a certain amount of money. So we had, this is what we could do with $200,000 in a biennium, or $100,000 a year. This is what we could do with $200,000 a year. So that was kind of the approach. And so, you know, we do have plans if we get a little bit more money. And in fact, the amount of, we've been leveraging so much more money that we have not planned, had not even planned for, that it's really mushroomed.
Okay, great.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Senator Shedry. Why don't you move the bill, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus budget bill.
I'll move that. What's the Senate file?
Senate file 1256.
Move that Senate file 1256 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill.
All right. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thanks.
We're going to have to rearrange the agenda just a little bit. I'm going to let County Commissioner Victoria Reinhart testify. She has to leave shortly. Do you need to be together? Or can you wait? Oh,
we're together.
Okay, well, everyone is asking to be put at the beginning of the agenda, so I apologize. I can't put everybody at the beginning, so I'm sorry. I've had a thank you for waiting, and I had other requests to be moved up. So we'll do our best to accommodate people's schedule, and I apologize if some people have to wait. Commissioner Reinhart.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and I appreciate being able to be moved up as well. When Ted Trulien comes up later in your agenda, he'll describe more of what the problem is, and I'm going to hopefully give you some of what we feel are the solutions. I'm here as a Ramsey County Commissioner, as a member of the Association of Minnesota Counties, or chair of their Environment Committee, and also as a member of the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board. And this year, we brought forward proposals to the Pollution Control Agency regarding two initiatives. First was the processing credit for solid waste processing. And you may remember that this was a credit that existed and sunsetted a couple of years ago. And we feel that it is very important, as we're trying to process more waste and put less waste in the landfills, to reestablish this processing credit. It was sunsetted, and the state funding for this, or the state MPCA's current strategic plan, calls for a combined proportion of municipal solid waste that is captured by the waste by waste energy facilities to rise from 20% in 2005 to 35% by 2011. Excuse me. And obviously, we need to provide incentives, and what's happening most often is that there are county subsidies, and many of the processing facilities that are out there as well are coming to their end of their 20-year contracts, such as with Ramsey and Washington counties, and it is difficult to say whether or not these facilities will be able to continue to exist without the county subsidies and without some assistance from the state. So we really need the state's help in the processing credit. We asked for $8 million for the FY 08 and 09 budget. And that, unfortunately, did not make it into the governor's proposal, but we do feel that it's very important when you look at the
trying to divert waste from landfills and use it in a more environmentally preferable manner to produce energy. One item that was included in the governor's budget, and I'd like to start by really thanking Commissioner Brad Moore. For the first time in 10 years, an increase in SCORE funding was included in the governor's budget. And they asked for the proposal that's in the governor's budget through Commissioner Moore was $3 million over the biennium. We do feel that that's a very, very good thing to have in place. However, we also know that we simply need additional funds in SCORE. SCORE was initially funded at approximately $31 million for the biennium, and over the years it has decreased and now has remained static at $25 million for the biennium. At the same time, and not much of a surprise really, the recycling rates have flattened and the amount of solid waste that's going to a landfill is increasing. One of the things that we feel would really be helpful here and would increase the SCORE funding is from the solid waste management tax. Right now, approximately $68.1 million per year in 2008 and 2009 is raised from the solid waste management tax. 70% or $47.65 million of these go into the environmental fund, and 30%, $20.45 million, go into the general fund. It's estimated, in addition to that, that there is an increased amount going into the fund at a rate of 1% to 2% per year in just simple growth. This is the first year, as I said, that any increases to the SCORE fund have been proposed. And although this increase is very much appreciated, it is not enough to resume the efforts. Thank you. to resume the efforts that many counties had to curtail or cut back because of the cuts in several years, over the several years. Even now, counties are going well over the match that was initially set to receive SCORE funds to operate their programs. So when you see the SCORE report that comes out, often counties just put in the amount that they need for match, but in fact they're spending many times over what the match that is required. There have been questions regarding what counties would do above and beyond what they're already doing to validate the need for the additional funding. And plainly said, additional funding would allow counties that have stopped doing recycling programs to potentially start them up again. It would also allow those counties who are still running the programs to provide more services to their citizens, because if we expect to raise the recycling rate, the fact is we need to have additional services that are available to the residents. These additional activities will help the state get closer to the recycling goal and sending less waste to landfills as we are trying to meet the state's goals. AMC and the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board would like to propose a suggestion to increasing the amount of SCORE funding that counties receive. The proposal involves the solid waste management tax dollars that are currently going into the general fund. About $20 million is going into that fund. AMC and the Coordinating Board proposes that the legislature phase in the transfer of these dollars to county SCORE funds over a five-year period. Each year, another 6% of the collections would be diverted from the general fund to the SCORE fund and go into the SCORE programs. And this is just one suggestion. Initially, these funds were supposed to all go into, they're collected for solid waste services, and they were meant to go back into that. But as with many things and many cuts that have and the decisions that you've had to make over the past few years, more and more of that has actually been diverted then into the general fund. So this is a way to get us back on track and to capture some of the increases that are coming into the solid waste tax fund and to get it back to the purposes for which it was really intended in the beginning. Are there any questions?
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Are there questions? All right. Well, thank you. I know we've talked about this, and it's a difficult, expensive problem to solve, but really important. So thank you for coming to talk to us about it.
Thank you, and thank you again for allowing me to go first.
Thank you very much. We've also been asked if Helen Palmer from the League of Women Voters could go next. So. Sorry. welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Senator Anderson, and thank you for allowing me to kind of insert myself into this meeting, because I'm not here to push for a bill or to ask for money. I'm here to make a presentation. My name is Helen Palmer, and I'm president of the League of Women Voters of Minnesota. Madam Chair and members of the committee, the League of Women Voters of Minnesota is pleased to present you with our recently completed publication entitled Examining a State Agency, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And I hope that each of you either has or will shortly have a copy of the study. I brought it this morning, and it's going to be – okay, great. This study is a result – This report is a result of a two-year study by the League of Women Voters members. And like all of our studies, is intended to educate our members as well as the public on an issue of importance to the state. Recent League studies have addressed such issues as alternative voting systems, immigration, agriculture, and choosing Minnesota's judges. League members decide the issue to study, a committee is formed, and the work, research, and interviews, and we had 33 interviews for this study, begins. A word about the League of Women Voters you probably already know, but I will refresh your memory. We are a resolutely nonpartisan organization. We are wholeheartedly political, however. We are a volunteer organization founded in 1920 when women achieved the right to vote. The League is the original grassroots citizen network directed by the consensus of its members. Our mission is to encourage the active and informed participation of citizens in government, and we work to influence public policy through advocacy. There are state leagues in all 50 states, some 900 local leagues across the country, and 42 local leagues in Minnesota. Why did we undertake the study of the MPCA? As a good government organization, we were interested in examining state agencies in order to determine whether they were providing adequate protection and enforcement for Minnesota citizens according to their charters. Members decided to look at the MPCA as an example of these kinds of agencies. We looked at the agency's charter, at its responsibilities, how it is organized. We wanted to know the current status of areas for which the agency is responsible. We looked at how the agency allocates its money and asked if it has adequate funding to carry out its mandate. We questioned how decisions are made, if the agency operates efficiently, if it applies regulations equitably, if it holds open meetings that are clearly announced, and if there is a mechanism for citizen input. We wanted to determine how transparent the decision-making process is. We wanted to know if the agency is responsive to all stakeholders, governmental units, relevant non-governmental organizations, business and industry, ordinary citizens. Our 33 interviews included ones with former Commissioner Corrigan, members of the Minnesota Senate and House, members of the MPCA Citizens Board, both current and former, and staff, representatives from industry, agriculture, the Chamber of Commerce, environmentalists, economists, scientists. We studied MPCA's and others' publications, court decisions, and media accounts. And I'm about to sum up. The MPCA is a complex agency dealing with complex issues. We hope through this study to shed some light on this complexity and to encourage public discussion around the state on the important issues that it raises for all Minnesotans. Our members across Minnesota are currently reading the document and holding meetings and discussions on the subject, and the League will determine as we go forward the advocacy role we want to play. In the meantime, on behalf of the League of Women Voters of Minnesota, I am happy to offer each of you a copy of the study and invite you to read it. The document is, by the way, also available on our website, which is lwvmn.org, www.lwvmn.org. And if at a later date you would like, committee members, if you would want to discuss the report's findings, I'm sure committee members would be willing to do so with you. In any case, we're all eager to hear your reactions to the report. And I thank you very much for allowing me to slip in today, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Palmer, and we really appreciate the in-depth work that you've done.
Thank you very much.
Really valuable.
Thank you.
Are there any questions? Senator Dill?
Well, Madam Chair, I noticed this on my desk at the last night, and I glanced through it, and it's here again in front of me. And I'm just wondering, Ms. Palmer, is there any key points you want to make that we can get out of this?
You know, I'm not going to do that. As I say, We raise a lot of issues. It's an educational report. And key points, I would say, for this purposes of this committee, if you're interested in the funding aspect of it, I would look at pages 12 through 14, and we could look at that right now together if you want. But I think it would be taking too much of the committee's time to get into that kind of thing. Key points, well, we're concerned. I think we raised concerns about the structure of the Citizens Board, the role of the commissioner, for example. We're very concerned about the funding, or I should say the lack of adequate funding for the MPCA. We are interested in the fact that the Citizens Board does not by statute include an environmentalist or a citizens advocate. It does include a person from the labor unions and from agriculture, for example. We are concerned that the MPCA, probably because of lack of adequate funding, is relying on voluntary compliance, for example, rather than actual regulation. We are concerned that the MPCA does not regulate agricultural chemicals. And that the regulation of feedlots seems to be decreasing. We are concerned about this rush towards ethanol, which is a wonderful economic benefit to Minnesota, no question about it. And the MPCA, of course, has to be very, very aware of the economic impact of what they do. But we're very concerned that the implications of ethanol be squarely faced in terms of potential pollution or use of groundwater or whatever. I could go on. Those are some of the things we're concerned about, but I don't have sort of bullet points to say, well, you know, this is what we found and this is what we think should be done about it. This is really, at this point, an educational document. And as I say, the League operates by consensus, and we will be determining how we want to advocate or if we want to advocate on what we have found. But thank you for the question, Senator Dill. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. I know you're rushed today.
Thank you so much. I know you're doing this as a volunteer, so we really appreciate
that.
Did
I say that?
That means a lot.
We're all volunteers in the League.
That's great. I grew up in a League family. My mom was the president in our town that I grew up in, and so I was well indoctrinated.
Excellent.
How hard you work.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
And we've also sort of been around a long time. I think it's 87 years at this point.
Wow,
we're still going strong. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we have a number of folks who are on our agenda who are from out of town or have long distances to travel, so we're trying to figure out how to accommodate everybody. We do want to take as much public testimony as we possibly can today in response to the governor's budget proposal. So I think we'll start with the panel from the G16 group, and then from there, if there are folks who are from out of town and need to leave, we'd be happy to try to put you next. Although I understand some of you are part of panels, and so whatever works the best, we'll try to figure it out.
I think Chris is in another meeting.
Oh, he's not here. So is Mr. Raddatz maybe won't be here, or is he?
Might not be
we're not sure
here.
If he'll be here.
Madam Chair, he's not here right now, so we'll proceed as the G3 instead of the G4.
G3. Well, it's great. It still warms my heart to see the three of you together at the table. That's always really encouraging.
Well, that's why we're here
so
today, Madam
back.
Chair. My name is Mike Robertson, representing the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I think we made a presentation to you about Clean Water Legacy at one of your first hearings earlier this year. It seems like a long time ago, but we just wanted to come back today to reiterate our support for funding for the Clean Water Legacy. As you know, the governor has included $20 million in his budget for Clean Water Legacy for each of the next 2 years. And beyond that, I would just say the needs are great. And I think we said at that time, and I think the committee has in its possession, the document that the G16 group prepared at the end of its work, which was actually about 3 years ago, but we think it's a valid document that we spent significant time working on the needs and the amount of money that could be spent in the long term, agency by agency, and the bottom line on that document was $80 million per year. So it's a significant need, and from the Chamber of Commerce's point of view, I'd like to just state our support for funding in this biennium for Clean Water Legacy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Robertson. Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Craig Johnson. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities, and I would echo everything that Mr. Robertson said. Very much appreciate the chance to come back in to comment on this. From the League of Minnesota Cities' perspective, we're very appreciative of the effort the governor made to include $20 million in his budget recommendations, but would point out that of the general fund needs identified for this program, that isn't even quite half of what it would be needed. Of the $80 million recommended for several years now, in a package put together by the G16 with the input from all the state agencies involved that would need to implement programs for us to meet our Clean Water Act standards in Minnesota, we did come up with a number of over $80 million, and about 60% of that would probably need to be funded by the general fund, between 55 and 60%. The rest, in particular, money for my folks to meet infrastructure improvement requirements, both wastewater and stormwater, obviously legislature could fund with bonding revenues to cover that. They could use general fund if they really wanted to, but I don't think you're looking for more places to find $50 million a year of general fund money. I would simply add that the package that we put together for funding on this really is an essential package. It doesn't really do a lot of good to find out that we've now got 4,000 impairments instead of 2,000 if we have no resources going into the on-the-ground practices to develop the non-point and point source controls we need to reduce those pollutions. All we're actually doing is creating a larger and larger unfunded need that we still haven't come up with any way to start chipping into. And there are very real repercussions. As we identify a water as impaired, it triggers Clean Water Act limitations on what can be done as far as new impacts of development of any kind in that area. And so we need to have a balance of finding where the problems are and funding the cleanup of those polluted waters so that we can get this work done. And we very much feel that the governor's budget made a nice start, but strongly request that the legislature see if they can boost that up to a level that comes closer to what it will really take to meet these requirements.
Mr. Johnson, I think you said the governor's recommendation isn't half. I think it's really, you were talking about $80 million a year, weren't you? So it's really, you're talking a quarter.
Madam Chair, yes, to clarify, when I said less than half, I was talking about the part that really could come from general fund funding or bonding. Yes, it would be a quarter of the total funding need for the Clean Water Legacy Package as a whole.
Thank you. Ms. Zeller, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marie Zeller. I am the regional director, recently appointed deputy director to National Clean Water Action. I'm still based here in lovely Minnesota, though. I was trying to think, Craig, Mike, is this our third or fourth year at this?
Fourth.
It's the fourth year that we've been before our legislature seeking funding for this program. Clean Water Action, as an organization, was one of the lead organizations nationally that actually helped to craft and get past the Clean Water Act over 30 years ago. Mike and Craig have been very polite, so I won't be shrill, but I will put a bit of a point on this. We came the first time around after almost over a year's worth of work as stakeholders to bring a funding solution, a funding option, new money to the table on this issue. 2 years in a row, that didn't get through. Now we're back second year in a row here trying to get some general fund allocation, appropriation. The problems are not going away. Water problems are cumulative. The price tag is going to go up, not down. I believe $80 million, you know, Craig put it that it's a, you know, essential package. I say it's a minimalist package. It's not getting us ahead of this game at all. I understand the choices and the priorities and the politics that are in play in a budget year, but I fear that we're going to be back next year and next year and next year, and the state is never going to make a true declaration that cleaning up the state's waters is as high of a priority as many of the other things that are nipping at your heels right now. We will be back. We won't go away. But it's been a long time coming, and will continue to come and testify and work for this. But the problems are not going to go away, and they're just going to get more expensive with every single year that we wait. So I urge you to do as much as you possibly can in this year and with this budget to address this problem and fund this program. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And I guess I have to make a comment myself. You know, I think we started off this session with you. It was our first committee hearing, and that was intentional because I believe that this issue is, besides the energy issue, which we are making really good progress on this session, this clean water is the fundamental environmental challenge facing our state. And so it's very frustrating to sit here now having received budget targets that I don't believe are adequate, honestly. And we've spent a lot of time, a lot of us, talking about trying to make sure we have enough in our targets to do the job for clean water. Many, many senators have weighed in on this, and some of us have begun discussing the idea that maybe it's time to go back to a fee, because that's, as you said, Ms. Zeller, that's where you started 4 years ago. And the legislature said, no, we don't like this fee structure, so we're going to do it with general fund dollars. Well, members, we can't just say no and not come up with an alternative, and we can't keep saying dedicated funding is going to solve this problem, because that's been going on for how many years? And it still hasn't solved the problem either. So I feel very, very strongly, as I know you do, about this, and frustrated that we haven't been able to come up with a good solution. So, members, any thoughts? Senator Frederickson?
Well, Madam Chair, Ms. Zeller, some of us took a really hard run at getting a fee the last couple of years, and we were not able to succeed at that. There was a good deal of resistance because there was a consensus that it should be paid for by some other broad-based tax or fee that would fund this. And I've always heard that this program, when it's when we are fully implemented, it's going to take $80 to $100 million. And I think our best hope is dedicated funding, with adequate amount of dedicated funding to fund clean water, and that is passed by a vote of the people. And I'm more optimistic than ever, Madam Chair, that this will be the year that we can make dedicated funding a reality. And the key piece of that for me is clean water. And I think the public sentiment is that clean water is probably the most important part of the dedicated funding proposal that we put before the people of Minnesota. Well, I want to see that happen. It's certainly something that I would work very hard to see passed. I would put a lot of effort and time into seeing the voters of Minnesota support it.
Senator Frederickson, I really agree with you, and I'm optimistic that this will be the year we'll get it done. I hope you're right. And I do agree also that clean water is what is going to drive that issue with the majority of Minnesotans. But, again, it's still wait. We're waiting and waiting and waiting. So it concerns me that we don't have a solution. Senator Chaudhry?
And I think few people are as enthusiastic enough about dedicated funding as I am. Having said that, at earliest, that's 2 years away, earliest. And so maybe the solution is and your target, how much of your target is just for inflation?
Well, so, I guess increase. I haven't announced. My ongoing money target that we've been given is $20 million, right, for the biennium, which is barely covers inflation. That certainly, it's the one-time money is really our only hope for clean water funding, as well as some of the other initiatives we're trying to do. Those targets have not been officially put out yet, so I have some idea of what they are, but they're not, I'm still hoping they're going to be higher, but what usually happens is they get lower. So we'll have, stay tuned on that issue. In the next week, we'll have more information about that.
So, Madam Chair, I guess my feeling is that, you know, I don't have a problem with education, property taxes, health care being top priorities. But if $20 million is our ongoing target, and that just covers inflationary increases, which I'm guessing not even cover all the inflationary increases, my feeling is that this a committee has been left to its own devices. And maybe instead of a permanent fee, perhaps, and instead of laying all our hopes on dedicated funding for the moment, perhaps we could have some sort of progressive fee that sunsets when dedicated funding is instituted. And then that would create the incentive to remove the fee. Well, let's get this passed. If we can get dedicated funding passed, we get rid of the fee.
Well, Senator Chaudhry, I think we have just a few days to try to think about that. But I think it's an idea worth pursuing. We've all heard the speeches about this. The environment, it's as important as it is to all of us. It always seems to be at the last issue when it comes to dividing up the pie. And so that's why we're facing this frustration. So, Mr. Johnson, did you want to say something?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'll be happy to talk with you more about the fee. If we need to talk about it, I can give you a reminder from a couple years ago that it was extremely contentious with the folks on the ground who would have to come up with the system to put into their software, into their billing, into their collections, getting it to the state, doing all of that work. I would very much like to work on that to avoid unnecessary wasted effort at the local government level if we can.
Well, and I think your process, the original G16 process, did look at a lot of different fee possibilities, didn't it? It wasn't, so we don't want to start trying to recreate that whole process. I understand a lot of us weren't real comfortable with the end result, the recommendation. Obviously, that's what happened. But so I don't know how difficult it would be to try to revive it in a way that would be, if we can figure out a way that's more, that works better, that we could get more support for. That's a big challenge, especially given the time constraints that we have. But
Madam Chair,
I think it's a good thing to throw out on the table and see if we can.
Madam Chair, I didn't say the fee from the last time we considered this. It could be any type of.
That's right.
Fee and admittedly the last fee wasn't so progressive and we can do that, but I mean I appreciate all the work from the G16 and that's important, but remember we're the ones with the election certificates here and we're the ones who have to lead and make this decision from the best interest of the state. Mm-hmm. And the only thing we need to decide is whether it's a priority.
That's right.
And once we do, with the rest we can figure out. Mm-hmm. We can figure out something. But we should figure it out soon. Now.
All right, good. Well, I think, thank you very much. I think this is starting, bringing us back full circle to where we started, and hopefully we'll trigger some creative ideas. So thank you very much for being here.
Welcome. Can I ask a quick question?
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Johnson, I see a little sign language down there. Does that sound like you're endorsing Senator Chaudhry's suggestion?
Mr. Chair, Senator, Madam Chair, Senator Dill, what I am intending to generate with my thumbs up is thanks that we will work on this together. There are a number of various fee options that can be considered, and I was simply trying to clarify that we were not for sure going to take one route or another at this point. That was my excitement, Senator Dill. Thank you for asking.
The devil's always in the details. We know that quite well. But Senator Chaudhry is right that ultimately we are the ones that have to lead and make these decisions and be accountable for them. So let's keep that in mind. Thank you so much. I think what I'll do is try to we have a number of folks on the agenda. I'll try to pick out those that are not from the Twin Cities to the best of my knowledge. So we're going to start with them and let you local folks wait. Sorry. So let's go back to Ted Trulin. Is he still here from St. Louis County? Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Ted Truline. I'm the director of St. Louis County's Solid Waste Department. I appreciate this opportunity to testify on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Solid Waste Administrators Association. I know that Victoria Reinhart has already spoken to you about this, so I intend to be extremely brief. I'm going to go through things very fast, and if there are any questions, I'll try to answer them. First of all, we'd like to thank the legislature for your history of strong support for effective waste management programs. Historically, Minnesota has been very dedicated to recycling, landfill abatement, resource recovery. That's through legislative leadership, and we appreciate that. We hope that can continue. We'd also like to thank the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency for including in the budget this year additional funding for SCORE recycling pass-through funding. As you know, counties receive pass-through funding from the state to help fund our recycling programs. That money started out at $15.5 million in 1989, dropped to $14 million in about 1990, stayed at $14 million all the way through the 90s, got cut again down to $12.5 million several years ago. Now the recommendation would be to bring it back to $14 million or bring it back to the level it was at in 1990. We do appreciate that we would be heading in the right direction with that. I'd like to point out, however, between 1991 and 2005, overall SCORE expenditures increased by over 50%. Those increases were all funded at the local level. They came from no additional state funding. As we've seen our costs increase, we are starting to see some counties opt out of the recycling programs, either opt out or severely cut these programs back. We've seen counties that have gotten rid of their curbside programs, gotten rid of some of their different sheds, especially in the rural areas, as their amount of funding has cut back. They've had to face some difficult decisions, and in some cases, those decisions have been, we're going to try to recycle less. I think it's very unfortunate. Sometimes on the local level, we do feel like the Greek figure in mythology, I think it's Sisyphus, is that the person that's pushing the rock up the hill, and we keep getting it darn near to the top, and then it goes rolling back down again, and we really are hoping that we can avoid having that rock roll down again. So we're starting to look, our share of what the SCORE Solid Waste Management Tax has collected, I think it started out up nearly 27-28%, we're down to 19%, and we've been seeing that get cut more every year. As a result, our recycling rates have leveled off. State financial support has been eroding steadily. We've seen some cutbacks in programs. And at the same time, we're seeing more waste generated every year. So along with everything else, the amount of waste that's getting put into landfills is going up every year. So as a result, it does feel like we're falling backwards. So funding is at least hypothetically available. As Commissioner Reinhart pointed out, the Solid Waste Management Tax does collect, being it's based on the amount of waste created, and we're creating more every year, and the tipping fees are going up, the tax revenues are going up, so there is more revenue that is being collected. We're hoping that perhaps in future years we can look at ways that we could try to capture some of that funding and redirect it back into some of the programs that tax was originally created for. We're in the uncomfortable situation right now where the tax is collected on solid waste collection and disposal. I think our residents have the idea that perhaps that's what some of the money is good, or that the money would be spent for. We also need to raise funds through other taxes on the local level. So in some ways it almost feels like we're taxing some of our residents twice to pay for the same programs. Anyway, I promised that I would be brief. That is as brief as I can be. But we appreciate your help. We're going to work with the Pollution Control Agency. We want to keep working with you. And certainly anything you can do to help us out on the local level so we can keep maintaining our programs, we'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Being relatively new here at the table, can you tell me where the solid waste tax goes right now?
The solid waste tax that's collected right now, I think it's collecting on an annual basis about $65 million a year. 70% of that tax goes into the Pollution Control Agency's environmental account. The other 30% of that tax goes into the general fund. So right now I know that we're, and we certainly are sensitive to the issues associated with trying to create new holes in an already in the general fund, and that's not something we would hope to do. We're hoping, though, that we can think of ways in the future that we can start getting back to where we started.
All right. Thank you. Thanks so much for being here. We appreciate it. All right. I think we'll jump down and take the Forest Industries panel. If they're all here, Daryl Wagner, Wayne Brandt, Kevin Wally, and Bud Stone, why don't you all come up together? Welcome to the committee. Mr. Wagner, are you first?
Hope not.
You, whatever you want. Whoever wants to go first doesn't matter to me. So in alphabetical order.
This is the Boxer, Brandt, Bud, and Wally panel here. Wayne Brandt, Minnesota Forest Industries, Minnesota Timber Producers Association. I will be brief. There are several priority things in the budget for the general fund that we'd like to draw the committee's attention to. First would be the reauthorization and funding of the Sustainable Forest Resources Act, the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. That's a $1.56 million item. It's currently slated to sunset on June 30th of this year. It is one of the key underpinnings of the sustainable management of our forests here in our state, and we certainly hope that that will be funded and that that program will be continued. I would note for the committee's benefit that going back into even the late 90s and the early part of this decade, that those programs were funded to as much as $1.1 million per year, so they have been streamlined. There were some activities that were shorter-term activities, developing some of the guidelines and such. So that budget has been significantly decreased through the years. Another key underpinning is private forest landowner assistance. There's $3 million in the governor's budget proposal for that, and that is a program, too, that has been cut significantly through the years and that provides information transfer on the best management of forests to private landowners. Two final general fund items, or three final general fund items. One is a one-time, would not have to go into the base study by the Forest Resources Council on the best tools for maintaining the forest, productive forest land base. The legislature has been very generous in funding programs in this area, but there certainly have been questions that have arisen as to whether it's best for the state to own land, forest land, and fee title ownership, to utilize conservation easements, to utilize different assistance and incentive programs. The Sustainable Forest Incentive Act is one of those, and also what role planning and zoning plays in the ability to maintain the forest land base. So that's a $200,000 one-time request that I think would be of great help to the legislature. That would, the Forest Resources Council would come back with an analysis of how best to utilize each of these tools, where they make the most sense, and where you're going to get the most bang for your buck. So I think that that, while it's a one-time expenditure, can help the legislature as you make decisions on that important area going forward. One item not in the governor's budget request was some funding for the interagency information cooperative. And what that funding would do would be further refine the technological management tools in modeling and growth and yield tables for the best GIS, also geographic information systems, also to continue to improve the use of those tools on managing public lands, state, and also would be helpful to the counties. Finally, there's $200,000 for priority research issues that really is targeted at looking at future questions. Those came out of the governor's task force on the primary forest products industry. The second set of issues are those dealing that would come out of the forest management investment account from timber sale revenues, and I'll just quickly run through those. The first are $1.5 million for boots in the woods, on the ground foresters out there. Second would be $2 million for improved forest productivity, utilizing pre-commercial thinnings, commercial thinnings, and other techniques to help our forests be more productive. $800,000 out of that dedicated account for inventory, and this is really a key one. The DNR is on a 15 or more a year cycle on doing their inventory. This would get them down to a 10-year cycle, and it's just crucial that the inventories be as up to date as possible for the management decisions. That will also provide some efficiencies within the Division of Forestry. Presently, they'll go out and survey about 70,000 acres a year to, and as they do that, they'll decide to harvest on a number of those, but when they go out, they find that many of those acres, the inventory data is not correct. And so they wouldn't have to do as much of that if we had the inventory up to snuff. And then finally, for all of our friends in the recreation and tourism and hunting and fishing areas, there's $2.2 million out of the dedicated account for forest road maintenance. I say that not facetiously, but 90% of the traffic on forest roads is recreational traffic, and the state has, I think, about a 2,000-mile system. We tend to use those roads, you know, once every 40 or 50 years, and the recreation folks use them the rest of the time. And it's important that they be safe and well-maintained. With that, I'd be happy to stand for any questions. Or do you want to save questions till the end?
No, it doesn't matter. If there's questions, we'll take them. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Brandt.
Yes, I'm Darrell Wagner, representing the Wood Fiber Employees Joint Legislative Council. And we're just here to throw a shore of support for the reauthorization of the Sustainable Forest Resources Act. We support the critical funding initiatives for the 2008 and 2009 biennium contained in Senate File 438. We're also supporting the truck rates, the additional 10,000 pounds of weight that we would be able to. We have passed it last in 2004, where you could haul the raw product in the wood into the mills, like the wood and stuff like that. Now we'd like to see that expanded to where they can haul the finished product, like the paper and the lumber and the engineered wood products, out of the mill. And that really makes sense, because it's, instead of having 15,000 pounds per axle, it's 16,000 pounds, it's down to 15,000 pounds per axle, which is easier on the roads, and it's 10% of the trucks are off the road, so, and it uses less fuel. It's a safety factor there. So,
all right, thank you very much.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Bud Stone. I'm the president of the Grand Rapids Area Chamber of Commerce, up in what we refer to as the land of mines and pines. It's the heart of the forest industry, and as you've probably read in the papers, we've had some pretty major tragedies in the forest industry up there, with the closing of Ainsworth and laying off of employees at Blended Paper Company a couple of years ago. I represent 600 members, business members of the Chamber of Commerce of the Grand Rapids area. It's a very, very large area. It stretches from Keewatin to Cass Lake and from Effie down to Reamer. A few years ago, the Grand Rapids Area Chamber and other chambers in the state supported efforts to establish the Forest Management Investment Account, and that was in order to help provide more stable funding resources for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources Division of Forestry. Today, it seems prudent to increase funding from the FMIA to the DNR Division of Forestry if we are to continue to enjoy the benefits of having healthy forests and healthy forest-based industries. Additional funding is needed to sustain a healthy forest economy in the state of Minnesota and to ensure that forests are managed for industry, tourism, recreation, as well as being conscious of the biodiversity of the species and the age classes of the trees. Specifically, we feel that an increased allocation in funding is needed in order for the Minnesota DNR Division of Forestry to cover the costs that they incur in generating monies for the FMIA. In order to help meet the financial needs of the FMIA and maintain the health of the state's forest lands, additional foresters, as Mr. Brandt stated, need to be hired to work on timber sales. Along with additional timber sales, there is a need to shorten the length of time needed to complete what's called cooperative stand assessments. A cooperative stand assessment is the tool used by the DNR Division of Forestry to help develop long-range forest management plans. And those plans contain, among other things, timber harvest levels, forest development plans, and wildlife habitat assessments. The DNR proposal would reduce the time needed to do those stand assessments from the 15 years that it takes today down to 10 years. Additionally, an accelerated forest road maintenance initiative is needed in order to provide safe, dependable access for DNR personnel and hunters, hikers, and bird watchers, and, as Mr. Brandt said, other users of the forest. Another item that needs consideration is the value of accelerating the implementation of what's called the ecological classification system on state forest lands. It's by classifying native plant communities, the DNR is able to make better decisions regarding the species of trees being used to reforest certain areas. It stands to reason that if you plant things where they naturally grow, your odds are going to be better in sustaining the health and productivity of the forests, especially on individual sites. Having that data is critical to identifying those locations and making sure that funding is available for them is critical. We would really, the Chamber of Commerce would like to eventually see all of the revenue created by the sale of timber on state-owned forest land dedicated to the Department of Natural Resources Division of Forestry so that there will never be a time in the future when the health of those forests are compromised, as they are in some instances. Lastly is the issue of non-industrial private forest landowners who annually contribute, believe it or not, about 50% of the timber that's harvested in the state. Additional investments are needed to help provide assistance to these private landowners regarding encouraging sustainable forest management practices. Because state, federal, and industrial forest lands cannot provide all the raw material that is needed to support the state's forest products industries. In the past, Minnesota was an exporter of forest raw forest products, and today we are an importer of raw forest products just to sustain the industries that we have. Today, I believe that the forest industries has slipped to fourth place as the largest manufacturing industry. Maybe it's down to third now. It contributes about $6 billion a year to the Minnesota state economy. The economic impacts are responsible for about 55,000 jobs. And a large percentage of those jobs, believe it or not, are in the Twin City, seven-county metro area. Most of the issues that I've spoken of are included in the 2006 Governor's Task Force on the Competitiveness of Minnesota's Primary Forest Industry. And we believe that investments in the DNR and forestry will help to keep our state's forested lands healthy and our state's economy prosperous. And thank you very much for allowing me to comment on this.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions? Mr. Wally.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Wally. I'm speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Forestry Association, which is Minnesota's oldest conservation organization, founded in 1876 to promote stewardship of forests. The MFA is made up of members who are non-industrial private forest landowners or family forest landowners. There are close to 6 million acres of family-owned forests in Minnesota. Approximately 50% of the total timber harvested in Minnesota is from those family-owned woodlands. Yet only about 20% of the family-owned forests have forest stewardship management plans in place. A research by the University of Minnesota indicates that landowners who have management plans in place are much more likely to implement management practices on their land and to maintain the forest resource. Managing these private woodlands as sustainable forests rather than having them be developed for other uses is vitally important to maintaining Minnesota's forest ecosystems and supporting our forest-based economies in northern Minnesota. The Blandin Foundation, recognizing the importance of forest management planning, has launched a Vital Forest, Vital Communities initiative with the goal of bringing another 1 million acres of family forest land under sustainable management plans. The MFA supports that goal, and that's why we strongly support the appropriation requested in the amount of $1.5 million for the Department of Natural Resources Private Forest Management Program. This will restore this program to a level that will allow more family forests to have sustainable plans in place. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Great. Thank you. Are there questions? All right. Thanks. We've also heard on this issue quite a bit over the legislative session, so thanks for bringing it all back together for us. Appreciate that. I think next we'll take the other group, the CERTS group, that also has some out-of-town testifiers. And then we'll go back to the order of the agenda after that. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for having us here today. My name is Lola Schoenrich. I work with the Minnesota Project, and I'm the Energy Program Director there. We're a nonprofit organization that focuses on the intersection of rural economic development and environmental protection. We've worked on a number of different clean energy projects over the last 10 years, and we're one of the Clean Energy Resource Team project partners. And I see some of you have the handouts. There's two of them about the Clean Energy Resource Team project. We call it the CERTS project, but it's not a breath mint, we sometimes say. It's included in the governor's budget proposal at $1 million for the biennium. And based on questions from several legislators, we'll lay out a proposal to increase that by 25% that would allow us to help more communities, including those in the metro area. CERTS is about getting energy efficiency and renewable energy projects up and running in communities all over the state. That includes wind, solar, biomass, biofuels, and all types of energy efficiency. It's a partnership between a public-private partnership between the Minnesota Department of Commerce, the University of Minnesota Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships, the Minnesota Project, and the Southwest Regional Development Commission. And I want to really start by saying that CERTS is important because it helps to achieve the clean energy policy goals that this body has passed already, the 25% renewable energy standard by 2025, and those that you're still discussing. And actually bringing renewable energy online, increasing our energy efficiency, launching that next generation of biofuels, taking action to address global warming pollution is going to take the best thinking and creativity of Minnesotans at all levels. It'll require academics to partner with communities, technical and business people to bring their best innovation and creativity to the table, local governments to step out in front, schools to teach the next generation of innovators, and eventually it takes all of us to use those new technologies in our houses, our vehicles, our businesses. It takes launching those new technologies and those new businesses and really making these changes takes innovative and creative people working together the way we did here in Minnesota with Medical Alley. These clean energy partnerships are actually already happening in communities today. Local schools are working with local utilities to save energy, and they're adding solar panels and small wind turbines so that their students will be ready for the future. Businesses like Rar Malting, Northwest Minnesota Grass Seed Growers, and lots of others are coming up with incredibly creative ways to turn waste materials into energy, and they're cutting their costs as they go. Local governments and lots of other community institutions are stepping out in front and winning awards, whether they be for the Blue Earth County Courthouse, green building renovation, or others. And CERTS is helping to make that possible. The project was launched in 2004 with an LCMR grant. We're now working on our second LCMR grant. We've attracted private sector funding from the Blandon Foundation, the Carolyn Foundation, and the Unity Avenue Foundation. And our current funding goes through June of this year. And without additional funding, sadly, the project would end. And so we are very glad to be included in the governor's budget. There really are teams, clean energy resource teams. The teams are diverse groups of people. They share common goals for their community's energy future. There are six of them. They cover all of greater Minnesota. The teams have 20 to 40 people that are actively involved and have been involved for 3.5 years now. There are hundreds of other people who participate in meetings and are involved electronically. The teams include, as I said, a very diverse group, small business owners, farmers, federal, state, local, government staff, elected officials, academics, educators, people from environmental groups, a broad range of people. We don't do any, CERTS doesn't do any public policy work, and we stay focused on projects. Your handouts have some examples of projects, and I'll just highlight a couple. There are a number with schools. The Proctor Schools, Wilmer Schools have energy efficiency projects, and some have installed solar panels, small wind turbines. The potential there is amazing. In the southwest part of the state, they're doing an energy conservation project, partnering with local utilities and senior centers to help senior centers cut their energy costs. In northwestern Minnesota, CERT's team has partnered with a research center at University of North Dakota to bring a biomass gasifier to try to help commercialize a biomass gasifier. And they've got local funding to do test burns of a variety of different northwestern Minnesota biomass waste materials, grass seed hulls, wood waste, and lots of other ones. There's a solar commercial kitchen in southeastern Minnesota. Partnership with University of Minnesota Duluth and communities in the Northeast to do wind monitoring. The list goes on and on. The CERT teams are not project developers, but they serve as catalysts to jumpstart projects, collaborations, and opportunities at businesses, farms, and homes. The teams are a great entry point for individuals who are looking for resources, and they work to nurture project ideas as they move to develop. Toward development. We provide connections between people through workshops, conferences, the teams. It turns out there's incredible technical expertise in this clean energy area and creativity all over the state. And what we find is that whether it's professors, teachers, businesses, engineering firms, contractors, these are the kind of people that get really excited when they have a problem to solve, a new problem, and when they find each other and begin to really work together, you can almost see them vibrate and they start to make things happen. I'll just close by pointing to a program evaluation that's being done by the University of St. Thomas, a couple of professors there. And they are finding that the overwhelming majority of team members feel that the CERT project has been a success in their region. What we're finding is that that success has led to greater and greater interest. There are more and more kind of local CERT teams, if you will, forming and all over the state that are linking to the regional teams. And so I'll just close by saying that the project is really important to Minnesota and to Minnesota communities because it is one of the things that is actually helping us on the ground to move towards that clean energy future that you all as a body are discussing.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions for Ms. Schoenridge? I don't see any questions right now, so go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I figure I shouldn't call you Madam Chair since that is slightly inappropriate. Members of the committee, my name is Lissa Polish. I'm the Clean Energy Resource coordinator for the University of Minnesota's Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships, and every time I say that, it's a mouthful. I actually staff five of the six CERT regions around the state, and Lola has done a really excellent job conveying to you what CERTS is really all about. In her last point, she mentioned that we're in this process of evaluation, and I think it's the real success that our partners feel that we've been and that participants feel that we've been that has led us to be included in the governor's budget. Our team members feel very strongly that CERTS should continue to serve as an educational, information sharing, and technical resource that stimulates project development. These team members are quite comfortable with our current staffing regime, but they also see all sorts of benefits and opportunities that could come from more regional on-the-ground staffing, more technical assistance in those regions, and more project funding on the ground. We have a great current foundation, and I think that with the governor's proposed funding in mind, we plan to really continue CERT's unique approach that allows citizens to directly impact their energy future through grassroots education, consensus building, and community-based project development. This continued funding will allow our state-level core activities to continue, including things like coordinating team activities, which is, in many respects, you know, workshops and on-the-ground meetings and tours, nurturing regional project development by connecting people with technical resources both within their communities and outside of their communities, maintaining strong communication networks. We have a website that gets thousands and thousands of new hits all the time. We have a great monthly update that goes out to both our regional partners and people that aren't formally on a team but are interested in energy issues. We will continue to organize our biannual conference, and we'll continue to serve as a mechanism for nonprofits, state agencies, and institutes of higher education to share their resources out to communities, but also to make sure that the community needs, aspirations, and desires are shared back to those organizations and help shape their work. With the governor's proposed funding, we also plan to expand on our recent success with regional requests for project proposals for technical assistance. We did a round of seed grant funding over the last year, and actually found that with pots of money as small as about $2,000, that we were able to attract all sorts of project ideas. We had over 20 projects that were proposed, 15 that were funded. Nearly all of those projects leveraged additional funds from within their communities and other organizations to make those dollars go further and actually get projects going based on technical resource assistance that we could help them provide. During this next phase, we hope to add more dollars into that pot to be able to spawn additional regional projects. We also hope to allow regions to continue to hire part-time regional staffers or technical assistants to advance their broader regional energy initiatives. The teams have had a lot of success with this so far, and a couple of examples include in the Southeast CERT region, of which Joe Deedon is a part. About 2 years ago, they hired a contractor. His name is Mike Michaud. He's a former state agency official that had been involved in transmission planning. And they really wanted to look at how distributed generation might impact where they could get wind development in their region. Well, he came up with a white paper that has now been the foundation for some of the studies that are going on with the CapEx 2020 proposal to look at distributed generation and how that works within the transmission infrastructure across the state. So they felt like that was a great launching point for them. Our Northeast team up kind of in the Duluth and over into the Iron Range area has really been interested in working with local schools. They want to see a renewable energy or energy efficiency project done at every single school in their region. And they hired two master's degree students from the University of Minnesota Duluth to help them work with local schools, start networking with local schools, provide those local schools with technical resources, and get the funding to get those projects happening on the ground. They've helped several schools install turbines and solar panels. The Proctor Public Schools started off looking at just a wind turbine. Now they're doing green building projects. They have their marketing and DECA groups looking at how they can actually market those within the community, how much the communities will bear in terms of additional costs for those buildings. And this has really catalyzed a whole range of projects for them, just getting started with the teams. Lola mentioned that in addition to the governor's proposal, we're asking for an additional $250,000 over the biennium. We've had great success in the region so far, and this has led several citizens and several legislators to ask us whether or not we might be able to serve the metro area. I think our answer to that is
yes, we could certainly serve the metro area, and we would do it, we propose to do it, by fostering local CERT development, so local team development in the metro. I should start by saying that not everyone likes the term CERTs. Some people want their own name. They have other creative acronyms that they might see. There are a lot of local energy groups that have already been formed in places across the metro and around the state. And we don't propose to go in and usurp what's already been done, but we hope to help these folks move their energy and energy initiatives forward. We have a CERT manual that we gave to all of our teams to kick things off a couple of years ago. We would see updating that, make sure that it has current case studies, new case studies. A lot of projects have developed over the last 3 years, and we want to make sure that we have the most current, up-to-date information in there. We'd like to include how-to information about how you form a local organization if you don't already have that. Help people think about how they both form the organization and then keep it going once you've started it. How they get projects developed on the ground and how those projects and identifying those projects can help lead to success. We propose facilitating local, we call them CERT creation workshops. I'm not sure that's quite the best term. But we'd use those to help provide technical assistance to those groups. We'd continue to provide them with ongoing technical assistance and update our website. And whether these groups are local metro area CERT or regional local CERTs that develop, we would really bring them into the fold of CERTs and make sure that they're part of our listserv communications, that they're part of our monthly update, and that we'd probably also have a biannual conference in the metro area to serve those specifically metro teams. Formation of these local groups has already worked in many regions. We have groups like PREACT McLeod, which have formed in West Central Minnesota, Sustain Winona, and Ohm CERT, which have both formed in southeastern Minnesota. Ohm CERT is short for Olmsted County CERT. There are also groups like the Region 9 Energy Task Force, which are now collaborating with CERTs and sort of forming their own offshoot of a South Central CERT. Not all of these groups are formal CERT organizations, but they all are networked to CERTs and focus on local energy education and project development. These are true citizen-driven efforts. They have no local staffers, and yet they've found ways to be successful drawing on CERT resources. We've actually already been approached by a group in the metro area from out in the Matamidi area, east of town. They're interested in having one of us come out and help them with a local workshop and strategic planning session to get their group going and help direct them in the right way. This additional funding that we're talking about would also provide additional resources for regional energy project development in communities around the state. I think, in conclusion, Minnesota has, with great thanks to all of you, innovative and forward-thinking energy policies in place, with seemingly more to come. To best implement and carry out these policies, we need an engaged and educated citizenry working together within their communities, creating local jobs and protecting our environment by implementing clean energy projects. We believe that CERTS has made great strides in helping the citizens of Minnesota achieve some of their clean energy goals. And we have the potential to do much, much more with your commitment to CERTS. We are very appreciative to have been included in the governor's budget, and we hope that you'll continue to support this project. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, please.
Madam Chair, my name is Jerome Deaton. I'm the executive director at Eagle Bluff Environmental Learning Center in Lanesboro. I'm here as a citizens representative of CERTS to let you know that what these two women said is indeed true and that we are having great impact on the ground. Lanesboro is southeast Minnesota, so when Lissa mentioned southeast, that's where I'm from and the group that I work with. But as an environmental, residential environmental learning center, I'm also part of a group of six centers around the state, Deep Portage, Long Lake, Audubon Center in the Northwoods, Laurentian, and Wolf Ridge, that are looking at becoming sustainable energy demonstration and education sites. And that working through the CERTS program, we worked with the University of Minnesota IREE program to do some design parameters on some of the sustainable energy projects that we're looking at implementing. We're also working with the University of Minnesota design graphic team to look at coming up with some eye-popping educational posters that we can potentially market. And I hope working with CERTS in the future that our sites will be used for future CERTS education programs. Lissa mentioned already the distributed wind survey work that was done, and I want to let you know that in Fillmore County, where I live, we had a meeting to talk about this distributed wind generation capabilities, and we had 78 people attend. Now, for a metro area, that might not be a lot of people, but for Fillmore County, it was a real eye-opener. There was a lot of concern that came out of that about people getting together and getting involved in county planning and trying to implement more countywide wind projects on the ground in that basis. So some of these things are working. They're not just studies that sit on the shelf that aren't implemented one way or the other. I'd also like to point out that in southeast Minnesota, we're interested in third crops, alternatives to corn and soybeans, that not everyone in us in the county wants to be have another ethanol plant on the corner of every county, and that we're concerned about groundwater drawdown and continued soil erosion caused by corn and soybean rotations. And working with the CERTS program, we were able to put on a half-day program on the cellulosic production of both ethanol and butanol. And ethanol or butanol is ethanol with two more carbon added on that is makes it more transferable. And that program is well attended. And as a follow-up, our local plant in Fillmore County in Preston is Procorn. And the Procorn manager, who I normally haven't had a good relationship following this meeting, is communicating back and forth with us. And he informed me last week that Broin management team, of which he is part of out of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, has received an $80 million federal grant to convert one of their Iowa plants from corn into what they're calling a cellulosic biorefinery. You know, so these things are moving forward. CERTS has been instrumental in giving us alternatives to ethanol, which is popping up everywhere. And then I do have to express the concern of the water drawdown and the continued soil erosion. Lisa and Lola both mentioned having regional staff people available and the funding provided to do that. It's very important. As a CERTS volunteer, we've gone around and put on educational programs in 15 different counties, and I've helped to do those in 5. But I'm not willing to make the room arrangements, arrange coffee, cookies, whatever else, and set up and doing all the advertising. And that's what these paid staff do for us. So they give legs to the program to enable the volunteers to have more impact. The CERTS process has been very guided in the 3.5 years that we've been involved. We've been assessing the regional assets. We've assembled information alternatives. And now we're working on disseminating that, which both these two have talked about. And I think the amazing thing that we found in southeast Minnesota, anyway, that we have with resources within our community to totally eliminate our need on fossil fuels. And we can become energy independent using sustainable energy alternatives. Lola and Lisa mentioned the interest of the CERTS being standard into the metro area, and we're kind of the living example that if you use Southeast as a model, that this could be expanded anywhere in the state, and I think it would be a great thing to do, and it would benefit a lot of people and provide even a greater audience. Over the last years, due to the continuing Iraq war and severe weather incidents, the public awareness around the uncertainty that surrounds our current energy systems has greatly changed. More people are looking for sustainable energy options. Approving the requested funding for the CERTS program would help speed the public's acceptance and implementation of both conservation measures, and sustainable energy opportunities. In closing, the current staff, Lola, Lisa, and Joel, are very efficient and responsive. They are a model of service of what I expect from any service agency in the state, but seldom receive. We are at a very important crossroads in determining our future. The CERTS program has and should continue to play an important part in this evolution. Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much. Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, I just want to pick up, sir, on what you said about that $80 million grant. I was in Washington, and I'm still trying to figure out. I thought that grant was going to be open to everybody. You sure that it's already been approved?
Madam Chair, Senator, all I saw was a press release coming from Broin out of Sioux Falls saying that the $80 million was going to, and I thought one plant in a city in Iowa that I have forgotten. But to me, it was very positive in the sense that there is hope for us that have ethanol plants in our communities that they can be converted. So I can't tell you specifically, but I can put you in touch with the Broin people to find out.
Well, Madam
Senator
Chair,
Vickerman.
The only reason I raise that concern, because I spent 3 days out there talking to Congressman Peterson, mm-hmm. and I'm somewhat shocked and amazed that they've already gave that money to Iowa. So I'm going to double-check on that. In fact, I'm going to do that in a few minutes.
Yeah.
I need to know what's going on here.
Madam Chair, Senator Vickerman, if I may just add real quick,
I believe it was last Friday that the Department of Energy posted an announcement that did issue funding for demonstration commercial scale projects for cellulosic ethanol. But I think that this is funding that came out of the Department of Energy, and I think it was funding that the proposals were submitted probably over 6 months to a year ago, and it was at least 5 or 6 awards that were made across the United States. And I'd be happy to send you more information. I even have a link, I know, on my computer, and I could send it as soon as I get back to the office today.
I want to raise that question, Madam Chair, because we're trying to, in my committee, trying to find money for cellulose energy.
Yep. Say, call your congressman
really
quick.
Talk to him. Blindsided here. There's already $80 million going to the next state.
Senator Fredrickson?
Madam Chair, Ms. Pollage, could you send that link maybe to our committee staff and they could disseminate it to us, because it's something we're all interested in.
Indeed,
that's a good
I will.
Idea. Thank you. And Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Deedon, it's good to see you back for the committee again. Oh, I don't know how many years you've been coming here, but it's
10.
It's a decade or more. But I was curious about what you said about the Eagle Bluff and the other 5 environmental learning centers. I believe you said you're going to have sustainable energy demonstration projects.
Correct.
Are you going to incorporate those into your curriculum at the environmental learning centers, or are they going to be demonstration projects for the community? Could you give us just a little more detail what your plan is?
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, I'm sure we'll probably be back in front of this committee some point in the future, but we're looking at the residential environmental learning centers around the state, and if you look at the impact that we can have, last year we had 68,000 students from the state participate in our educational programs. So we have an opportunity to get a sound, renewable energy, sustainable energy message across to state students, mostly 4th through 8th graders, but we work K through 12. So Senator Fredrickson specifically, we will develop curriculum that goes out and works with all the schools, but we also want to become community assets. And I think that's one thing that we didn't anticipate when we originally sought the state's support of our projects, was the value that we have of becoming community information centers and helping get information out to those in our surrounding community. So we will be both adult education and student education as this moves forward.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. We need to move on. Thank you so much for your presentation. Members, we hadn't heard from the CERTS program at all, even though they were recommended in the governor's budget, so we just heard about it from the governor's staff. So this is helpful to get from the agency an overview. Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, I just want to interject that I have had very positive feedback from my constituents in Southwest Minnesota about the Southwest Minnesota CERTS.
Great. That's very good to hear. Yeah, I've heard good things, too. Although we don't have – I really want one in the metro area, too, so I hope that we can make that happen. That'd be very cool. And I think I'm not alone in suggesting that. Members, I'm going to try to adjourn about noon. That's my plan, just so you know. And if we don't get through the whole agenda, we've already told the very last panel probably they could leave, because I don't think we're going to quite get through the agenda. But we'll get as far as we can, and whoever we don't get to, we'll schedule for Tuesday. So next we've got MCEA. Ms. Wolf just left. Does anyone know if she's coming right back, or should we go on to
She's standing right
out. Okay. All right. There she comes. Go ahead. Well, let's get started. We really don't have an awful lot of time. And we've heard a lot. This is sort of a lot of this is what we've heard before, so we're just going to try to have a keep it as brief as you can. But we appreciate you being here. Senator Chaudhry.
While they're getting set up, Madam Chair, I apologize. I do have to leave for an event outside the Capitol. I just wanted to mention, going back to the League of Women Voters report on the MPCA, it was glossed over a little bit, but I've had a chance to peruse it. Mm-hmm. This is one incredible, incredible document. Mm-hmm. It really is. I mean, to get a primer on what the PCA does and the issues and some of the controversies surrounding legislative functions and the board's makeup and all of that. I plan to read it cover to cover. I've been enthralled with just the few pages that I've read.
Yeah, it's very, very well done and
really
very
informative.
Detailed and
really
substantive.
Informative.
So I recommend that to all members to read. All right, welcome to the committee. Who's first? Ms. Wolf?
Madam Chair and members, I'm Allison Wolf from Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and I'll be very brief. I know you've had a great discussion about clean water funding this morning, and I think one of the benefits of having the long history of advocacy on clean water is that we have quite a few resources. I'm just handing out a couple that will remind you of things you have seen in the past, especially Senator Frederickson will find the spreadsheet that was used to advocate for his clean water bill very familiar looking. But in 2003, the legislature got a report from the PCA about clean water and what the needs were and what the funding costs would be to address the Clean Water Act's needs to assess, prepare cleanup plans, and then carry those cleanup plans out. So I just handed out a couple of pages from that report that is a good reminder of the fact that these numbers have been around for a while. And the G16 agrees with these numbers. You're always going to see some variation in the figures. But this report in 2003 from the PCA said that we need $8 million a year for assessment, and also went on to create quite a range in the restoration area to clean up the waters that went all the way up to $3 billion a year. So we've always been dealing with quite a range of funding needs. And if you look on the little second page of the report, you'll see that that range applies just to the non-point restoration work. So point source restoration work does not even fall within that estimate. And I skipped over the TMDL preparation. That also was estimated in that 2003 report at $8.9 million a year by the PCA in its report to the legislature. So those numbers have been around for a while. And then on the final page of the handout is the investment plan summary. That was the document that was prepared to support Senator Frederickson's Clean Water Legacy Act. And you'll see that in 07, the request was for $40 million in general fund. And as everybody knows, it was a $20 million, or actually $15 million in general fund. And then the total numbers are $79 and $80 million for the 08 and 09 years. So these were numbers that were created by a large group, including stakeholders of the G16, with input from all of the agencies that administer the Clean Water Legacy Program. I'll turn it over to Matt in a second, but I just wanted to offer an analogy that will help us think about the water program a little bit. If we're trying to assess the health of our waters, it helps me at least to think about it as a human health type of issue. We've only gotten to assess the health of our waters to a small degree. We've done 10% of our streams, 16% of our lakes. So if we were doing that with a human population, that would mean 84% of our folks weren't getting blood pressure screenings, cancer screenings, you know, basic health checks. We just don't know if they have health problems that need addressing. So that's where we are with a lot of our waters. They're not even at the clinic. They need the screening, and they don't have an appointment yet. So I think that, you know, then you have the group of folks that have been assessed. They know maybe that they have high blood pressure. They're waiting for a doctor's appointment so the doctor can tell them what to do about the high blood pressure. So then we have over 2,000 impaired waters that are in that situation waiting for the help they need to get the cleanup plan to help them move to the next stage. So creating those cleanup plans is kind of like a prescription where we've found impairments in our waters. And finally, the actual implementation of the TMDL plans is maybe getting the prescription filled at the pharmacy. And so there are only 5 completed TMDL plans that have been approved by the EPA. I think it's still 5. Paul? 6. I'm informed by PCA folks that another one has been approved. So those are folks who have a prescription, and there's maybe even waiting in line to get that filled. And some work has been done in those watersheds to begin restoration of the waters. So it helps me to think about that in sort of a healthcare context, but I think you can see from that analogy we've got a lot of unmet needs to take care of our waters. And I would just join the earlier voices today in urging you to do whatever you can to fund Clean Water Legacy so that we get beyond the clean water start to the actual clean water legacy that is an ongoing stewardship effort to really responsibly take care of our waters.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wolf. And we're realizing we don't have any health insurance in your analogy. And a lot of people are going to end up at the emergency room, which is
on
very
Saturday,
costly.
On Saturdays.
On Saturdays, that's right. And that's where we're headed if we don't do this. So thank you. That was a helpful context or analogy to use. Well,
thank you.
Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Ms. Wolf, if I could carry the analogy just one step further, I'm sorry, it's like puns. I just can't avoid
them. You can't
help himself.
The point, your prescription probably would be for point source pollution. And for the non-point pollution, I think that requires a lifestyle change.
That's right.
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, I like that because I think what you have is multiple inputs. So if you had a high blood pressure situation, the analogy would be, you know, exercise, weight loss, you know, reducing your salt intake. So it could be a number of different steps to take.
Yeah. That's right. That's right, the preventive side. All right, Mr. Norton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. I do the forestry and wildlife advocacy work for Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I want to speak in support of a number of components of the proposed budget for forestry, enforcement, ecological services, and fisheries and wildlife division of the Department of Natural Resources. Most of the things that I speak in support of have already been supported by Wayne Brandt and a number of other folks, Bud Stone and the two other gentlemen who appeared earlier today. The department does need additional boot foresters, new foresters to come onto their staff. The Division of Forestry has an age profile, which means, as a matter of course, that a substantial number of experienced foresters will be retiring in the next several years. That's not a problem that's limited exclusively to the Division of Forestry, but they certainly do need the money that is proposed in the governor's budget to hire some of those new younger foresters. In addition, the dollars that are proposed to help the department implement and train their staff in the ecological classification systems is sorely needed. It's an important component of Minnesota's effort to practice the very best forestry in the country. And it has substantial benefits for forest productivity as well as forest health in the bigger, broader sense, not just the sometimes more limited definition of keeping fire and insects out of the woods that timber industry interests use, but the real complete ecological health of the forests. I do want to say that while we support the various items in the governor's budget for the Division of Forestry, it's important, I think, to take some careful consideration of exactly how that money is appropriated. There has been in Minnesota for a long time a separation between the revenues generated by timber harvest and the Division of Forestry's budget. And it's passing that money from timber harvest, those receipts, through the general fund so that the legislature makes an informed decision that weighs a whole range of factors in deciding how much money to give to the Division of Forestry for the next year for additional timber harvest and forest management has a salutary effect, I think, on how the department operates. We don't want the Division of Forestry to become overly dependent upon a dedicated fund because the concern is that you get into a situation where the Division of Forestry gets to hire based on next year based on how many thousands of acres they harvest this year, and that it's just a concern. Currently, there is a small amount of the budget for the division that comes from that dedicated account, and I think that they deserve all of the revenue, all the money, rather, that is proposed here, but we think that it should come from general fund and that those receipts should then be cycled back into the general fund. So, in a couple of items regarding the Division of Ecological Services, I want to support the terrestrial invasive species proposal for the Division of Ecological Services. In fact, it's mirrored by a similar small allocation in the Division of Forestry to hire some people to try to get non-native invasive species under control on DNR lands. Those are very important things. It should be a multidisciplinary effort. There have been a couple of bills, and I'm not sure if you are familiar with them, but a couple of very generous bills offering free hunting and fishing licenses to members of the military. And I think that that is a wonderful and generous thing for the legislature to consider doing. However, you should be aware that that would create a hole in the Division of Fisheries and Wildlife budget. And there should be some backfill for that if the state is going to be generous in that way. We don't want to be cutting the Fish and Wildlife Division budget. Ecological services, back to ecological services for one moment. There is a real pressing need for two full-time equivalent employees in the Division of Ecological Services. There may be others. These are the ones that I'm aware of. The DNR currently does not have a prairie native plant ecologist for the southwest region of the state. At a time when we are focusing a great deal of energy and interest on prairie biomass, that is a glaring vacancy, and we really need to do something to fill that. A second similar position in ecological services would be for an assistant native plant community ecologist in the metro region, partly because the DNR has changed the dimensions of the metropolitan region, the metro division in the DNR, by tacking on six or seven counties in the Mississippi Blufflands area to the metro region. That means for ecological services. And so the eco-services employees now have a much bigger and more diverse area to manage. They need one person to assist the existing native plant ecologist for the metro region. The final thing I guess I'd like to say is that the governor's budget does have money for the Minnesota Forest Resources Council. However, there are a couple of needs in the Forest Resources Council that are not being met. One is for a small amount of money, and you'd have to ask staff for the Forest Resources Council, but we estimate approximately $75,000 per year in this biennium and $40,000 per year in out years for support staff to run the Forest Resources Council's landscape program. The Timber Harvest Generic Environmental Impact Statement, which the state bought and paid for back in the mid-90s to make sure that we are managing forests well in a way that takes account of the wildlife and other values that we have in place on our forests, said that in order to protect those values, we have to practice forestry on a landscape scale. And that requires collecting information from the different land managers and trying to lay out some very broad plans for how all the different players are going to design their timber sales, so the big picture fits together and protects wildlife and all the other values. They're currently getting about $5,000 per year for each of the implementation committees, which are they cover enormous areas. The Northeastern Landscape Committee covers the entire Arrowhead. They have a $5,000 budget to do things like pay for research. It's completely insufficient. Another $75,000 per year would allow the landscape committees to do the work that they have to do. And it's very important we support that work because it allows continued timber harvest while at the same time protecting all the other values. The last thing is the governor's budget proposes, I believe, approximately $200,000, one-time money, to study a number of issues that were identified in the primary forest product sector task force report. The subject of that research is a completely new subject to the Minnesota Forest Resources Council, and it's being added to the council's activities at the same time that some statutorily prescribed existing research needs are not being funded. And again, these research needs address biomass. We do have now some very quickly drawn up biomass guidelines for harvesting at the site level. But the guidelines committee, the biomass guidelines committee, has tried to be very clear. There's a certain scope to those guidelines. They do not answer all the questions that desperately need to be answered before we go all in and start looking to our forests to provide a substantial amount of energy. It'd be a big mistake if we do that before answering these basic research questions that have been identified by the Guidelines Committee. And so I would propose either that the governor's budget dollars be reallocated from studying the primary forest product sector's economic equations to studying the environmental effects of biomass harvest first, or we find an additional approximately $200,000 in one-time money to answer those questions. With that, I'll take any questions you might have.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Norton. A lot of food for thought. Any questions? All right. Thank you so much for testifying.
Thank you.
Okay. Next, we've got the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Molly Schultz, and I am the Public Policy Director for Conservation Minnesota and the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. And I am going to sum up state spending on conservation in 3 minutes. We need to get out of here. As many of you are aware, Conservation Minnesota is the organization that does an analysis every year of the governor's proposed budget, and then at the end of the year we do an analysis of the state spending overall. Cheryl Appledorn is with us, who is one of the people who works on the report. To sort of sum up, what we saw this year with the governor's budget is there were some modest increases that have been proposed, but overall, conservation spending as a share of the state budget continues to hover near a 30-year low. From 1976 to 2001, the state spent an average of 1.83% of the general fund on conservation purposes. By 2006, this shrunk to 1.00%, which meant that barely 1 cent of every dollar was spent on conservation purposes. In 2007, the Clean Water Legacy money, the sort of burst of cash that came from Clean Water Legacy, caused a slight uptick to 1.15%. For 2008 and 2009, we are at 1.16%, so we're just not increasing at any real substantial levels. In inflation-adjusted dollars, total expenditures for the primary conservation agencies, which when I'm using the PCA, the DNR, Bowser, the Department of Agriculture, the LCCMR, and the Metro Parks budget, declined $100 million from 2001 to 2009, and that is an 18% drop in funding for those budgets. While some other areas have seen cuts in their growth, meaning that they're not growing quickly enough to meet their increasing needs, our area has actually seen a going down reduction. It's not that we're growing more slowly. It's that we're not growing at all. We're losing ground. Every year that the budget comes out, we're just not keeping up. The inadequate funding means that that the agencies can't plan. I think one of the things we talked about was the Clean Water Legacy funding and how expensive these problems are. They're also very complicated and a lot of times require multi-year solutions. Without adequate funding to sort of look beyond a year-by-year approach, we're just not going to be able to make significant headway in addressing a lot of the problems and challenges facing the state. I wanted to turn it over to Steve to...
Okay, great. My name is Steve Morse, and I am the Executive Director of Minnesota Environmental Partnership, and it's a pleasure to be in front of this committee. I know it's been a long hearing, and I appreciate you hanging out here on almost a Friday afternoon to listen to some of these issues. I, too, will be brief so that I know there are others who still want to testify. I see some of our friends from the Breckenridge chapter are here, and so we do also want to hear from them. As I think you realize, MEP, Minnesota Environmental Partnership, is a coalition of more than 80 nonprofit organizations, environmental conservation organizations across the state, representing more than 450,000 Minnesotans. And we have made it a priority since 2002 to address some of the budget issues, but specifically to address our agenda of Protect Our Waters. Madam Chair, we certainly share your frustration that you've expressed and others in the committee have expressed, Senator Frederickson and others, of our inability to act on this issue. It is a core Minnesota value. It is how we identify ourselves here in Minnesota. We link ourselves with our waters and our lakes, rivers, and streams. And quite frankly, we're not doing right by this core Minnesota value. In 2006, we did have a good start, as we've heard. However, what we know is that that was one-time funding, and the governor's recommendation of $20 million for continuing base funding for Clean Water Legacy is really backsliding from where we were even last year. And we understand the budget target numbers that you've been presented with and that you mentioned, Madam Chair, and it really points us to the direction of what's going to happen with the supplemental one-time funding. We feel, as a coalition, very strongly that we need to be thinking about and targeting a full $100 million to implement the Clean Water Legacy. And with the difference between the $20 and the $80 million is really cleanup. Are you going to test, plan, strategize, and do a little bit of cleanup, or are you going to test, plan, strategize, and actually get about cleaning up the waters of the state? That is the difference between doing a nominal amount such as $20 million, $30 million, and doing the full funding. Our concern is that if we do not get full funding for Clean Water Legacy at this time, we'll have a long time before we come back and actually do commit the resources that we need to do. Allison Wolf pointed out the numbers that we're using for this $80 to $100 million range that you're hearing is based on the 2003 numbers. And the range then was kind of the middle number was maybe $250 million a year. No, it's an upper number, $250 million a year at that time. Since then, let me again just review some of the numbers. We're now up to over 2,000 impaired waters, 2,250. 40% of what we test comes up as polluted for a number of reasons, human, animal waste, mercury, or other contaminants. Approximately 86% of our waters have not yet been tested. And we have approximately 60,000 straight discharges from septic systems yet in the state. So we've worked on this for a number of years. This is our fourth year, and I think Senator Frederickson first brought up the issue today of the user fee. You know, let's just look back and how we've talked about funding this over the number of years. The user fee was brought forward 4 years ago, 3 years ago. It hit some pretty rough waters here in the legislature, but I do think it is appropriate to start thinking about if we're not going to get ongoing base funding, what are the mechanisms that can be done in order to actually get us where we need to go? We are very open to looking at user fees and offering support for different users' fees as long as they make sense. Our preference is to link something so that it is linked as closely as possible to the polluter pay principle so that those that are paying are those that are responsible. We also support the general fund approach. That's what our current request is, along with the G16, who you heard from earlier, that we've been engaged in from its inception. We think that makes sense, but obviously you need to get the money. We were very impressed 2 years ago when the Senate fully funded Clean Water Legacy and did it by linking it to a closing the what's it called operating recognition, I think.
FOCs.
Whatever. Overseas operations. I don't have the terminology on that. That was great, but obviously it didn't pass. We hope that wasn't just for show, and that was actually an indication of where the Senate's going to be now when possibly we can get another mechanism. And if it's linked with a tax increase such as that, we'll certainly look at that. The other option, of course, that everyone is looking to and was talked about today is the constitutional amendment. We think that is very viable. We know that the public will support raising their own taxes to pay for clean water. That is what can drive the constitutional protection for clean water, habitat, and other things that may come under that umbrella. We know the public will strongly receive an amendment to protect our great outdoors. But even if we do a constitutional amendment, as I think you're all aware, we need something this next biennium. And again, we are asking that we go with the full $100 million, even if it is one-time money. I personally am very intrigued by the discussion you had of a fee and what Satvir's comments or Senator Chaudhry's comments in that regard, and the idea of doing some one-time money this year and hooking it with a fee that even if that's not entirely palatable, but having it almost as a trigger mechanism so that if we do not get the constitutionally dedicated funding, then have the fee mechanism kick in. It would effectively give the public the choice of a fee or a sales tax increase to decide how they want to do their water cleanup. We know they want to clean it up. We know they're willing to pay for it. We know it's a sticky, difficult thing to get over. $100 million is a lot of money in this day and age. But we also realize that even with that $100 million, according to the numbers you just heard, it only brings us back in inflation-adjusted dollars to where we were in 2001 in total environmental funding. So although it's a lot of money, it's not like it's a big, overwhelming boost and we're going to jack everybody up higher than they were some years ago. There's been such loss and such attrition over time that it only gets us back to where we were. And as we look forward, going down the road, what we see is continuing competition for the state general fund dollars and other dollars that unless we do something that goes beyond the pattern that we've had, all of us, or in the legislature over the last number of years of slowly, incrementally adding money or taking off money, we're going to continue with this very severe chronic condition that Allison talked about, and it's going to continue to get worse and worse. And I personally don't want to be in the state when we can hold our head in shame and say we're the land of 10,000 polluted waters instead of 10,000 polluted lakes, which is where we'll be when we get through our testing cycles. And so I know the choices are tough. You have limited options on the table, but on behalf of the 450,000 Minnesotans within our organizations, we implore you to take the leadership and step up and come up with a package that will provide full funding for Clean Water Legacy so we can actually go out and promote it as a true legacy.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions. All of us would be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, if you can stay just a few more minutes, I'd really like to get through the Minnesota Waters and the Isaac Walton Lake testifiers today, and then we will adjourn, and we'll lay Senator Rummel's bills over till Tuesday. So come on up, please. We're running out of time, so we need to keep moving. I know many of us have other places we have to be this afternoon. We're not done working for the day, believe me. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Dick Osgood. I'm on the executive board of Minnesota Waters and also serve as their public policy chair. With me today are Terry Christian and Eric Lindberg, and we're going to speak in support of the governor's and DNR's aquatic invasive species bill. While they get set up, I just want to piggyback on the testimony you've heard with regard to the Clean Water Legacy. While I'm not speaking specifically for that, I would point out that to the extent the state makes a commitment to clean up our waters, the job won't be done. When aquatic invasive plants and animals get into them, those too will pollute them outside of all these other cleanup activities that should occur. So I'll ask Terry Christian to kick this off.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators. I'm Terry Christian, representing Minnesota Waters Invasive Species Task Force. I grew up on the south shore of Leech Lake, and I now live on Medicine Lake, which is the second largest lake in Hennepin County. I am the Lake Association President. I have seen firsthand the devastation that aquatic invasive species can deliver to lakes. Minnesota now has 800 lakes identified with curlyleaf pondweed and 190 lakes with Eurasian water milfoil, as well as lakes being diagnosed with rusty crayfish, zebra mussels, and other non-native species. Mille Lacs has zebra mussels, and Leech has rusty crayfish. A recent DNR survey of rusty crayfish in Leech Lake found 46 crayfish per square meter of lake bottom. Both zebra mussels and rusty crayfish affect walleye fisheries. The damage from aquatic invasive species is ecological, economical, and social. On the front page of the four color document is a picture of an algal bloom caused by curlyleaf pondweed. I took that picture on Medicine Lake, which is on the list of Minnesota impaired waters for too much phosphorus. What happens is that massive numbers of curlyleaf plants die off in late spring and begin This releases soluble phosphorus for immediate food for algae. The decaying mass settles on the bottom and uses up the available oxygen in the water, causing anoxia. Anoxia is a condition that allows the sediments at the bottom of the lake to release insoluble phosphorus that is bound to it. Therefore, even more phosphorus feeds the algae. This is a water quality issue. In the last 3 years, more than $300,000 has been spent to treat curly leaf pondweed in Medicine Lake, and since treatment began, we have not had another algal bloom of this magnitude. Treatment works. Also very expensive. Just think, this is one species, one lake, and look at the cost. We did get a grant from the DNR the last year of treatment for $20,000. A few weeks ago, I attended this committee's hearing, and I heard Senator Bach address the committee. He started out by agreeing that aquatic invasive species is an important issue for the state of Minnesota. It deserves to be addressed. He talked about honesty in government and that we should raise money to pay what is needed to address aquatic invasive species. He described many homeowners on Minnesota lakes that put their boat into the lake spring and take it out in the fall. Their trailers are simply storage units for their boats. I am one of those. In 23 years, our boat has only been in our lake, so I know we did not affect Medicine Lake with curly leaf or milfoil. In spite of that, I am very much for the fee. The first year of treatment in Medicine Lake was paid for by Plymouth Surface Water Management. The last 2 years were paid for Bassett Creek Watershed Management Organization. Bassett Creek recently completed their second generation plan, giving them a water quality focus as well as their traditional water quantity responsibilities. When they did this, they got Hennepin County to pass an ad valorem tax to have monies available for water quality work. This tax is paid for by every citizen in the Bassett Creek watershed. Because curly leaf pondweed has a water quality issue, it qualified for these funds. I see this as an example of taxing all citizens to pay for this. There are boaters who use the lake but do not live in Hennepin County. This is why we need a statewide program for all lakes. Another mechanism being used in the state to collect funds from property owners on the lakes is a Lake Improvement District, or LID. There are about 20 of these in the state, and more are being considered. An example is Lake Alexander in Morrison County, which collects $131 per year from each shoreland owner. Nothing is collected for the visitors launching their boats into the lakes, and these are the people that are bringing the aquatic invasive species to us. But it is not all citizens who are spreading AIS. It is the boaters. There are actually maps available showing that the infected lakes are mostly near major roads. It is not all of the boaters, as Senator Bach pointed out, but really the boaters are the vector. The governor's budget is asking for more money from large boats than smaller ones. It is the opinion of Minnesota Water's Aquatic Invasive Species Task Force that more small boats are moving from lake to lake, so the fee should at least be equal for all motorized boats. Today about funding coming from general funds versus fees. And one of the things that that Minnesota Waters is trying to do is to support the DNR's fee that is already in place. There's already a mechanism for collecting this money, and I think that would be helpful for us. It is also a concern about tax versus the fee for long-term funds. General fund source of funding is short-term and unpredictable. We've all heard that here today. Fee is an ongoing and fair assessment shared by all citizens who use the lakes. What has been happening is that the local citizens have been carrying the full burden of controlling the invasives once a lake is infected. A fee would at least spread that load to all voters.
We need dedicated funding in the state long-term to address not only the aquatic invasive species that are here, but more that are coming. Thank you. We need to fund this threat at a level that makes sense for the real needs of the lakes in this state. Lake scientists who have been helping us with curly leaf pondweed treatment tell us that because of the probable existence of the seedbed, or turions, that we can expect to need ongoing maintenance treatments. The Plymouth Surface Water Management Fee has budgeted $15,000 for this for 2007. However, it is unknown if this will be enough or when a full lake treatment may be needed in the future, and that's about $100,000 a year for one lake for one species. There is agreement on the Minnesota Waters Aquatic Invasive Task Force that this is a crisis at this point for Minnesota lakes and rivers, and it's time to do the right thing. Our lake association paid extra to the DNR for more inspections at the public ramp last year because of our fear of zebra mussels. Zebra mussels is now in Lake Mille Lacs, where 550,000 boats drop in and out of there every year. The amount asked for is only $6.66 per year per boat. To put it in perspective, a can of two dozen worms at our local bait shop is $3. This is not asking for a lot of money. You can help us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry. I'll ask Eric to go next. We're having some technical difficulties, so you'll have to enjoy our wits and charm.
All right.
My name is Eric Lindberg. I'm a resident of Plymouth, Minnesota. I'm a volunteer on the Minnesota Waters Public Policy Group, and I also support the Lake Minnetonka Conservation District with respect to automated launch monitoring.
You need to bring your microphone real close. These are not very good microphones.
How's that?
That should be better. Thanks.
Great. I don't want to take a lot of time here. I know we're running short and give you the background on Eurasian water milfoil and curly leaf pondweed, which is the number one phosphorus producer in lakes, which is what the Clean Water Legacy is part of what they're focused on addressing, or zebra mussels, which are already in 100 of our neighboring lakes in Wisconsin and can be transported by 68 boat launches in Minnesota already off of the Mississippi River and Mille Lacs Lake and Ossawinna McKee. So we won't talk about the details of, and I can't show you the pictures of how they impact, but imagine, if you will, beach is not covered with sand but covered with zebra mussels. Imagine, you don't have to imagine, go out to Lake Minnetonka in the summer and see how dense the Eurasian water milfoil is in 30 feet of water. And we have mapped all the lakes in Minnesota that have been designated by the DNR as infested waters. And if I could show you this map, it would look like a spider web moving out from the metro area from when we first had Eurasian water milfoil discovered in Lake Minnetonka back in 1987. And it's moving to counties around Minnesota, and we've mapped the primary vector as being trailers and them carrying weeds with excuse me, zebra mussels on them. I get all choked up over this issue. There's a significant impact to associations on this. With just seven associations where we know they're spending their own money to do control, that is treatment for the invasive species, they're spending nearly $1 million annually on this with no support. And this is due to the fact that there are visitors coming into the lake that are transporting aquatic invasive species. The property values are being impacted as well. We've got a letter from a member of the Board of Realtors up in the Brainerd Lakes area who says there are multiple purchase agreements being canceled when the people find out there's aquatic invasive species on those lakes. Reading to that long-term effect, our tax revenues are going to be impacted the more we have the spread taking place of aquatic invasive species. In some studies that were done by DNR interns on Lake Minnetonka in 2005, they identified that 14% of the boats leaving that lake have aquatics, that is Eurasian water milfoil, attached to their boat or trailer. In those cases where they were there, they were able to stop the boater and have them remove those. However, the challenge is that it's a very expensive proposition, and right now the LMCD invests in 2,000 hours worth of intern monitoring for the season, but that only addresses 6% of the need for monitoring these boat launches to have the people either clean off the aquatics before they get into the lake or clean them off before they go to another lake. And from 1987 to today, we've seen the trampoline effect of this Eurasian water milfoil spreading from Lake Minnetonka to 190 other lakes. I'm not even talking about curly leaf pondweed, where over 600 lakes are infested with this. And zebra mussels are on the horizon. We have seen maps of the spread on the state of Michigan. They have 235 lakes already with zebra mussels infested, and there's no treatment that you can leverage against zebra mussels. So prevention is really the only thing that you can do. Wisconsin already has 100 lakes that are infested with zebra mussels. So they've got 400 lakes with Eurasian water milfoil. However, Wisconsin has funding available to the DNR to provide to lake constituents to help them battle the issues of monitoring at the boat launches, of early identification of invasives infesting a lake, rapid response to that, and empowering the local lake constituents to take action on behalf of what's in their backyard, which is a resource that we can't recover from. Once it's infested, you can't get rid of it. It's just ongoing control that is necessary to take place with some types of treatment. So we've seen that the prevention cost right now is approximately 10% of what the control cost is. So fast forward 10 years from now, if we have a similar exponential or we encounter an exponential growth of lakes becoming infested, we'll have a very significant monetary challenge to treat these lakes and provide control against the invasive species that are already there. One of the challenges that the DNR faces is they just don't have enough resources for enforcement. In 2 years and over 5,000 hours of conservation officer time focused on this, only 23 citations were issued. Even though there's a law against the introduction of invasive species into a lake, there is not the expectation of an enforcement by the general public for launching their boats into these waters. There's not enough, and they need the resources to do a better job to help enforce the laws that we have on the books right now. In Wisconsin, they have $1.5 million that comes out of their gas tax revenues that's dedicated to AIS education and prevention, and that is partnered with local lake associations or lake districts to match their efforts to take action to keep the invasives from coming into their lakes. So we're way behind. We're under attack. Literally, at Lake Minnetonka, I spent 750 hours last year at the boat launch as part of this program for the LMCD, and I saw boat after boat after boat coming into the boat launches there, bringing invasive species in. And when they saw that they were being monitored by an intern or they were being monitored by an automated system, they would inspect. And we were able to get reductions, but that was not around the clock. So that's the challenge that we have with our lakes. We calculate that it's going to be on the order of $270 million if you put 10 hours of monitoring at a boat launch for all the boat launches for 10,000 lakes in Minnesota. We don't have that kind of revenue, so we got to stop it now from spreading before it gets any further. So we're completely behind the DNR's budget for creating a dedicated account for this, and Dick's going to talk more about our amendment to that budget.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. Again, my name is Dick Osgood. Myself and my two friends here are here as volunteers today for Minnesota Waters. Minnesota Waters is in life to promote the stewardship of our aquatic resources, lakes and rivers in Minnesota, and we do that through engaging citizens and policymakers like yourself. I am an aquatic ecologist by training and education. I professionally am a lake manager. I work as a consultant. One of my contract jobs is to serve as the executive director of the Lake Minnetonka Association, and I'm currently president-elect of the North American Lake Management Society. I'm here today as chair of Minnesota Water's Public Policy Committee. Eric and Terry have said, we support the DNR's aquatic invasive budget, but we are recommending increases in funding for some areas already in that budget and some additional areas as well. The need is great. Aquatic invasive species, ugly, pesky plants and animals that get in our lakes and rivers are harming them in many ways. The number of infested lakes and rivers is increasing. The number of kinds of these plants and animals is increasing. And our reliance to date on mainly on voluntary compliance and enforcement is not adequate. We're losing the battle. We need, we believe, an imperative to stop aquatic invasive species not yet in our lakes and rivers and to better control those that are. As a result, Eurasian water milfoil, for example, infests 10 lakes per year and has done so for the last 20 years or so. This is too many. The state of Wisconsin, for the first 30 years they had Eurasian water milfoil, had 2 lakes per year being new milfoil lakes. The other problem with that, and the one impediment for not having a PowerPoint, is my cool graph here. But I'll do it using hand signals. Yeah, 10 lakes per year or 2 lakes per year goes like this, but at some point, all biological invasions do this. If you can see the red line, that's Wisconsin. After 30 years, Eurasian water milfoil, number of lakes, did this. We're not there yet. At 10 lakes per year, which is still more than what Wisconsin started with, we're accelerating faster than they are. As Eric mentioned, Wisconsin now has 400 lakes with Eurasian water milfoil. We stand to have many more than that very soon. The other thing that speaks to the need, by comparison, I was invited to the Indiana Lake Management Society a couple of weeks ago. They have found hydrilla, which has recently been characterized as the perfect weed. We do not yet have that. The state of Indiana is spending more money to get rid of hydrilla in one lake than our DNR's annual budget for all aquatic invasive species. That's how serious they're taking it, and what the DNR's budget proposal is aiming to do, and we think should do more of. As a result of all this, aquatic habitat, fish, fisheries, and water quality are impaired and damaged, and we are recommending that the boat license surcharge be increased from $5 to $25 for this. The DNR's budget proposal recommends either a $5 or a $10 increase over and above the current $5 increase, depending on the size of the boat. We are recommending a $20 across the board increase in the boat license surcharge.
Mr. Osgood?
Yes.
I have to adjourn this meeting. I'm very sorry. I have to leave, and I hate to have you talk to only one other senator. I would invite you to spend some time with members of the committee if you are able to. I know we had this. We went through this in detail in my office, and I appreciate it very much. But I apologize. I have to leave, and you know, Senator Rummel, if you want to stay and chair for 5 more minutes while you finish, that would be fine. And I appreciate you being here.
We can adjourn to my office if they like.
So I'm sorry, we're just out of time, and we've tried to be as patient as we can. And I apologize to all the people who have come and waited. And our next testifier already left, and he's been here for many hours waiting for his turn as well. So I think we'll just have to end now and adjourn. And thank you very much for the information. And I would encourage you to try to spend more time with committee members if you are able to, and I know you've been trying to do that already. So thank you so much for your testimony, and the meeting is adjourned.